Cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Two days of long, intolerable, and forced silence is finally over. The week has begun. It's Monday, another broadcast week on America's Liberal Voice. What a show Mark Levine just had for you. Just anytime you hear somebody who's really done scholarly work on Reverend Sun Myung Moon and the Moonies, you can't help walking away just going, because it's nuts. It's crazy. And frankly, I think Mark and John Gorenfeld could have done 3, 4, 5, 6 hours on it and still had stuff left over. I mean, the holdings in Brazil and Argentina and Paraguay and... Oi! Crazy people. Thank God for freedom of religion, huh? Even if it's Mooneyism. Oh, what's a poor guy to do? But that's okay, because there's other... Mark did an hour on Reverend Moon. That doesn't mean that there's no other insanity out there. We are chock-a-block in insanity. Yes, absolutely. And it's a special time of year for certain of those among us. It's a particularly special time of year. The advent of spring is upon us, and that greatest of spring rituals has arrived. About this time of year, I always like to read. Well, mostly what I do is read. But about this time of year, I like to watch a movie from the 40s or 50s. I can't remember exactly when it was made. Somebody can IMDb it and find out. But a wonderful, lighthearted little film that features Ray Milland called It Happens Every Spring. Black and white, charming, fun for the whole family, about a baseball fan whose love for the game leads him to accidentally on purpose discover a substance in his chemistry lab that makes the baseball dance. And for a time he gets to relive his dream of pitching in the bigs. Baseball season is upon us. The national pastime, as it was once known, before the advent of the NBA and the No Fun League. A game that is bounded not by time nor space. Uniquely, as they like to say, American in its nature and its origins, although a lot of it goes back to, like, cricket and stuff. So when you're opening the season, it is, as you know, traditional to have some dignitary throw out the ceremonial first pitch. Now, if you go back and you see the grainy old black and white movie footage, you'll see, who was it? Was it Roosevelt or Taft that was the first president captured on film? And one of those, or maybe, I can't remember, or maybe it's Woodrow Wilson throwing out a first pitch, and he's in the stands, and he just kind of tosses the ball down onto the field to somebody on the field, and they catch the ball. Yeah, okay, ceremonial first pitch, hurrah. Well, not anymore. No, 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 because we have a manly man for a president. Hmm, ha. He's a man. And he, being George W. Bush, threw out the ceremonial first pitch at the new Nationals Park, the Washington Nationals, yesterday, in or near D.C. And it was so bad, that before the game, a couple of players from the Atlanta Braves gave him a team jersey and suggested he wear it to throw out the first pitch at Nationals Park. And Dear Leader chuckled and guffawed and said, hey, no thanks, guys. Might as well put on a sign that says, boo me. I'm not going to give him any excuses. As in give any excuses, was the 40,000-plus crowd that was on hand for the opening day, not only of the national season, but of their brand-spanking new ballpark. Don't worry, sports haters. We'll be done with this segment in just a moment. But you really do kind of have to hear the response. They introduced all the dignity, the manager, and then the general managing general partner of the Nationals. Then they introduced Dear Leader, who, by the way, did not throw out the ceremonial first pitch to Tony LaDuca, the catcher, who was, I believe I mentioned this maybe Friday, you know, he was just mired and mentioned numerous times in the Mitchell report on juiced up, steroided up baseballers. So in order to avoid embarrassment to the president, the starting catcher for the Nationals didn't get to catch the ceremonial first pitch. Instead, the manager came out to catch. Oh, God. Is there an end to the embarrassment? Do we really get an end to all this embarrassment in January of 2009? Will it be safe to go back to an opening day in Washington, D.C. without seeing this hateful little murder monkey? Well, guess what? It really didn't matter if Dear Leader wore that Braves jersey or not, because he came out in a satin Washington Nationals warm-up jersey, and this is the scene as it existed.
And managing principal owner of the Washington Nationals, Ted Lerner.
Now, that's a pretty friendly crowd, sounds like, doesn't it? And they've already given a nice little ovation to the manager. But wait, there's more.
And here to throw out the inaugural pitch at Nationals Park to mark a new era of Washington baseball, the President of the United States.
You know, I really wouldn't mark any new eras with George Bush these days. Because the next thing you know, he's out there telling you that you're about to turn the corner, or this is a defining moment, and you know, the next thing you know, you go, you know, 0 for 162 or something. But anyway, yeah, just feel the love coming from the crowd.
The President of the United States.
Now, I don't know if it's coming across the radio box this way, but in my little earphones, that is some pretty doggone lusty booing. I mean, that's the stuff that you reserve for the, I mean, that's like WWF booing, you know, when the guy with the black tights and the black hood comes out and has the, you know, steel, the nickels rolled up in his hands or whatever, and he's going to cheat and play dirty and stuff, and all the little grannies in the folding chair. Boo! Boo! That's that kind of booing. But there's more to this, really, and you don't want to miss it. The two ESPN guys who were calling the game, well, this is just comical.
There have been many presidents who have thrown out first pitches, but I don't know that anybody's ever done it better than this particular president.
Oh, 40,000 people venting their hate and disgust for a human being, and what do you get?
There have been many presidents who have thrown out first pitches, but I don't know that anybody's ever done it better than this particular president.
That was a neat time.
And usually they go to the front of the mound in these ceremonial first pitches, presidents or otherwise. He goes right up on the mound again, just as we saw him at the World Series at Yankee Stadium in 2001, soon after September 11th.
Oh, I'm going to vomit. Can't even get through a ceremonial first pitch with 9-11, dear leader. 9-11, y'all. Oh, he strode manfully up to the. Thank God Chris Matthews wasn't there. He would have had a furrow in his trousers or something. It's opening day at the ballpark. The ballpark is supposed to be a special place. A carefree place. A place where we put aside our fears and our worries, and we watch grown men who enjoy the extremely well-paid privilege of playing a little boy's game. And instead, this lick spittle of a... And I can't remember the guy. I mean, obviously the other one was Joe Morgan. But for the life of me, I can't remember the play-by-play guys. Joe Morgan is the color commentary, and the play-by-play guys, I can't remember. I've heard him a million times on the radio and on the TV. Sorry. John something? But to sit there... Well, I don't think that anybody's ever done it better. Well, it's the only daggum thing you can write down on George Bush's presidential resume that he's done better than any other president. Well, he didn't go up there and throw it like a Nancy boy, like Bill Clinton. There wasn't baseball in Washington. But most presidents go to the foot of the mound. He strode manfully up to the rubber, and there's Joe Morgan in the background. Oh, that was some high heat. It reminds me of how manfully he did it in the days following September the 11th. There is nowhere that this poor, pitiful, terrified little country can go anymore that we aren't beaten over the bloomin' head with September 11th. You know, George had to hear those boos. Yeah, it's probably a bunch of Democrats. The Democratic National Committee probably bought up all the tickets so they could boo me and humiliate me. Oh, Laura, I don't think they love me anymore. God Almighty. But, you know what? There is, yea verily, an upside to this. With any luck at all, that is the last opening day pitch we will ever have to see George Bush throw out. Now, by hook or by crook, he may wind up throwing out a first pitch at the World Series or the All-Star Game. Here's hoping that since our votes didn't count at the ballot box when we tried to keep him out of the White House. Here's hoping that maybe we can express ourselves even more loudly the next time he tries this. But I'm sure that the play-by-play team will be right there. My goodness, can't you hear the cries of the adoring faithful? Jeez. Oh, and you guys are right. Yeah, John Miller. John Miller was the guy who was lapping at George Bush's undershorts. Oh, I've never seen it done better. And I'm also reminded, please remember that, Bob, that's John Miller, the most practiced apologist on the planet. Why, you ask? He's been the lead announcer for the San Francisco Giants for 12 years. The unscrupulous bastard's been propping up Barry Bonds for 12 years, 162 times a year. oh, that's not going to play well with our Giants fans. But yeah, it's John Miller and Joe Morgan. Eh, sounds like John being diplomatic. Okay, I guess I can buy that. I mean, I'm not asking for anybody to throw the rotten tomatoes. No. But I think it goes beyond diplomatic to suggest that to bring September 11th, 2001 into the equation. The one thing this country needs to do more than anything else is get back to our sense of whatever passes for normality in this country without being whacked over the noggin with September 11th again and again and again and again and again and again and again. But there's no getting around the booing. There is just no getting around the booing. I love the comments on this one blog where the story was mentioned. He's been pitching Americans BS for 7+ years now. Did he throw a screwball or a slider? No, baby. That was a spitter. Pure and simple, just like he has spit on the American people for yea, verily, almost 8 miserable, long, seemingly interminable years now. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Hi, Bob, it's Kevin again.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Nothing much. You know, I'm continuing on this moon trip. I'm looking at the official website.
Oh, the Moonies?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
No, go right ahead.
A funny bit of trivia. You know, remember the Million Man March?
Yeah, the Louis Farrakhan and, right.
Yeah, and also the Million Family March that followed?
Right.
Guess who was co-sponsored?
No.
Yes. Talk about strange bedfellows.
Well, I guess maybe it's a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah.
But Moon is equal opportunity. I mean, he'll get in bed with anybody.
Oh, yeah. And I'm looking at their website, and you would think, oh, man. You have to look at their website.
What is it?
It's like...
No, I mean, what's the addy? Just so people can be as dumbfounded as you sound like you're being dumbstruck.
I just looked up Reverend Sun Yung Moon, and, you know, they have the Wikipedia, which tells the truth.
Right.
Pretty much what he is and what he's all about. And then, you know, go on to, like, his website. And then what's so funny about all this, you would think it is, like, this totally legitimate... And he talks about, like, when he was investigated, the persecutions he went through during the 80s.
Persecutions?
Yeah.
It was persecutions he went through. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Now that I know that. Yeah.
But he owns a huge estate up in Westchester, New York. And strange enough, New York has a large Korean community, which owns a lot of, you know, grocery mom-and-pop type shops, you know. If you want to get your fruit, you usually go through the Koreans. And they supposedly he's helped finance a lot of those.
Well, it blew me away when John and Mark were talking, and John pointed out that I guess he's got the sushi market cornered in the United States, and that just gave me the crawling, creepy heebie-jeebies. Yuck!
Yeah, and it makes me want to start boycotting sushi. But we may also have to boycott sushi and fruit, because... If you want to get your fruit, pretty much, and if you don't want to go through the Walmarts or the big, you know, the big supermarket chains, and if you want to join a mom-and-pop shop, you got to go through the Korean community for the most part, who are Reverend Sun Yung Moon affiliated in New York.
You know, what happens when this evil old SOB dies? I mean, he's like 100 years old already, isn't he?
I'm reading something on his daughter, Injin Moon.
But, I mean, okay. He's the Messiah and everything. He's got to come back or something. I mean,
well, in the meantime, there has to be a Messiah until he comes back, and she's a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. So who knows? She may be groomed to take over the family business.
Are there no admission standards left at Harvard whatsoever or Yale? I mean, they let in Bushes, they let in the Moons.
Well, I don't know. It's like the whole. You know what it is. I'm going
making me feel better about my non-Ivy League education a little bit more every day.
Oh yeah, same here. Same here. You know, if Stanford could allow Condoleezza Rice, you know. But you know, I'm going through some personal stuff, and I've been attending, you know, a meeting or two.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy who spoke at the meeting said, you know, his parents were graduates of the University of Chicago, which is a pretty prestigious school. They also started that whole right-wing economic.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. If you graduate from the University of Chicago, you get a degree in whatever you get a degree in, your bachelor's, but you also get an automatic you get an automatic minor in mean.
Yeah.
That's the meanest university on the continent.
Oh, yeah. And he never graduated college, but he's lecturing at the University of Chicago, teaching businessmen how to act, how to basically BS. You know, how to show, you know.
Yeah, how to make it look right.
Yeah, exactly. And he's coaching business people at the, some of the best business schools in the country on how to do this. But yet his parent, and his parents for years kind of, you know, snubbed their noses at him because of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like one of those nonsense. Hold on for a second.
Sure.
So it's like one of those nonsensical things that, you know, truly the most successful people will get knowledge wherever they can get it.
Oh yeah, and you can absolutely. I mean, there's the great Ivy League educations confer as much status as they confer knowledge, depending upon the student. It's all student intensive.
Oh yeah, and you know, I look back at Benjamin Franklin, who never went to college, but he was given all these honorary doctorates to the point where he was, you know, truly a self-made man.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, throughout his life, he started lecturing at the various universities, and it goes back beyond that, where I think...
Well, look, Bill Gates is a college dropout.
Oh, yeah.
So is Rush Limbaugh. Well, he's a community college dropout, Rush Limbaugh is.
Well, he's a dropout of society, or humanity. You know.
Yeah, I don't think there's any elitism to a college education. But
well, they're trying to make it an elitism.
Yeah, only by virtue of limiting the number of people who can go. Instead of more, we wind up with less, and that's how we wind up in the spot that we're in.
Yeah.
Right. Because you take people who, I was rereading over on Joe Bajan's site over the weekend, and he cited a statistic that just filled me with horror. The majority of America comprehends politics on a sixth grade level.
Oh yeah, I definitely can agree to that. You know, after my adventure out in the Midwest, I could again, it goes back to Washington Post, Fox News, right wing radio.
Yeah, and trust me, the right wing is not happy that America generally. Conceptualizes politics on a sixth grade level. They're rather disturbed about that. They're worried about it because the Republican Party wants them to comprehend politics on a third grade level.
Yeah. But okay, now I get it, because I was about to say, I'm expecting the average American to comprehend politics at least at a high school level. And I guess I've been asking way, way too much. It's kind of like when I first started getting into teaching, I expected my students to read on grade level. I learned very quickly I needed to lower my expectations a lot.
Yeah, because if you test on grade level, your curve's going to look like not much of a curve when it comes to grading.
Bob, if I test on grade level, I'll be fired.
Jeez.
Okay. And I've been, put it this way, reprimanded seriously for expecting a 14-year-old to read on the ninth grade level.
What a ridiculous expectation, huh, Kevin?
Oh yeah, how dare I?
Now wait a minute. Okay, my son, who is in sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
is reading on about an 11th grade level.
Yeah.
What constitutes an 11th? I mean, I know there are standards, but I figure maybe you're a little bit more familiar with them than I am. What constitutes a ninth grade level? I mean, you know, we're well past C-spot, run.
Well, me personally, I would say being able to read. Okay, me personally, I think if you're able to read the New York Times and comprehend it, you're reading on at least an eighth grade level. Or the Washington Post.
So does that mean that the Washington Post and the New York Times write on an eighth grade level?
Well, most of us do, whether we know it or not, read. Well, that's all you really need, Bob.
Oh, dear.
No.
Oh, dear.
It doesn't really mean you're stupid or anything.
No. But, I mean, there's a lot of concepts out there that I wouldn't hand to an eighth grader and say, you know, dope this out.
Well, that's lack of maturity. It's not lack of skill. There's a difference. Okay?
Okay.
George Washington, his formal education ended at the eighth grade.
Well, what level of formal education did Abraham Lincoln have?
Less than that. But again, you know, skill and maturity are two different things. Skill, discipline, and maturity.
Is it because with the advance of technology and so forth, there's just too much stuff to cram into too little time? Is that it?
Probably that, and you know, it's a lot of factors. You know, I think you bring up a good point with technology surpassing morality and man's capability at the moment. But I think eventually technology will be a blessing where, to the point...
Well, if we last that long.
Yeah, exactly, where we'll all be equalized in the end. I just think...
Oh, I think that's the disturbing part of it. We will be equalized in the end, but I have a horrifying idea that the equalization is downward and not upward.
Yeah, that too. You know, we're all going to die.
No. I mean, like I said, I spent a lot of time on just sort of catching up on Joe Bagent this weekend because he's such a wonderful conversation and he's an even grander writer. And this concept of the big die-off is absolutely fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
And horrifying and terrifying all at the same time. And I guess the question becomes one of what are the things that matter? And, you know, you see it in other cultures or other time periods as well. I've mentioned on this show in the past that within three generations of my family's arrival here, there were segments of my family that had become illiterate. And they were descended from the single greatest publisher in Edinburgh, Scotland. How do you go from being a publishing magnate of the time to being illiterate in three generations?
Well, the thing is, and this is the problem, political and global events. The reason why your average inner-city kid, whether or kid in Appalachia, transcends, and a lot of kids do come from a similar background where three generations, their grandfather might have been a doctor or an attorney, is because political events, lack of stability, and a whole lot of, you know, basically undercutting government, good government, has forced the downward living cycle to people. You know, it's kind of hard to learn when you're focused on getting your next meal, keeping your lights on.
Right, and it's hard. Well, I mean, in the case of my particular family, it's hard to focus on literacy when there are arrows flying past your head.
Exactly.
And I'm not making light of the situation, and frankly, you know, my family was probably on the bad end of the transaction. It was we who were invading them, and under the same circumstance, well, you know, you'd shoot too.
Yeah, exactly, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, and for typical inner city kids, and I can vouch for this, you know, it's hard to get an education when you have to worry about getting shot at, getting beat up, being hungry, you know, avoiding your drunk or drug-addicted parent.
Yeah. So I guess all we can do is work on a, on an individual basis, but I look around, and again, if I begin to sound like an elitist, somebody smack me down because it's not my intent.
No.
We're raising our kids a certain way, Kevin.
Well, we're raising...
Well, I mean, I'm talking about Agnes and I and our, you know, our unique little family.
Okay.
And by unique, I mean...
Very unique.
Oh, well, not that kind of unique.
Oh, I know, but very unique. And put it this way, your politics alone, Bob, from the region of the country that you come from, makes you a unique family.
Well, okay, fair enough. Point taken. But we're raising our kids one way, and we go out into the little community where we live, and we see kids who are raised wildly differently. And by wildly, I mean I use the word wildly in its dictionary definition, because there are kids in this tiny little community where we live who, once they got out of diapers and were able to get along on two legs with relative competence, you know, out you go. Oh, you're going to go play on the streets until midnight. Fine, see ya.
Oh yeah. Well, that story's not that different in the inner cities.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's not racially quantifiable. It's not ethnically in any wise. It's not linguistically quantifiable. It is ignorance is a function of the desperate poor.
That too, but you know what, Bob? Here's the question we gotta ask. Okay, in Japan,
yeah,
they have the same problem. It's not uncommon to walk through the streets of Tokyo. But matter of fact, it's a bigger problem. Okay? It's not uncommon to walk through the streets of Tokyo at midnight, 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Because, you know, they talk about New York being the city that never sleeps. Tokyo makes New York look like a cow town. Okay? And to see school children in their uniforms wandering the streets at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. How come Japan doesn't have the same problems that we do?
Maybe when they do go home, either the educational system's better, or when they do go home, there's some level of reinforcement. I don't know. Homogeneity of the society, I think, speaks to some of it.
I think because, first of all, they have a well-functioning, for the most part, well-functioning government.
Okay.
And, okay, there's free health care in Japan. Okay. Free public school system, which is on the top notch in any country in the world. Okay. A very good function transportation system where you can reach any part of that country. In Japan, it's not a... Naturally speaking, Japan is not an easy country because it's a very mountainous country.
Sure.
To build a railway system. Okay? And it has a society where people, and it's burned into the brain, where it's not about me, it's about we.
There is that as well.
The nail that sticks out gets hammered in.
And you don't always want that across the board.
No, you don't.
But the thing is, make
room for individuality.
But we have, and the Republican Party, heaven knows, Kevin, has been very, very good at hammering home. Speaking of hammering, this notion: oh, America's a land of rugged individualists. There's not a rugged individualist left in this country.
Oh no.
I mean, there might be some crotchety old dude up in the wilds of Idaho. I can take on the world, but no, there's not. It just doesn't happen. And anybody who thinks that they have made, I'm a self-made man and rugged individualist and all of that stuff. They're just not paying attention.
Well, I think Darwinism has been a BS philosophy to begin with, because, yeah, I understand the survival of the fittest thing, but if that was truly held true, humanity would not have had a chance.
That's the thing, though. People misinterpret the survival of the fittest, though.
But in the Western, the classic...
I mean, if you've got two individuals who are otherwise all the same, and one of them is born, and this isn't even fair because evolution doesn't happen on an individual basis; it happens on a populational basis.
Yeah.
But if you've got a segment of the population that are all born with one leg longer than the other, and the other segment of the population is all born with equal length legs, the equal length legs people are gonna. That segment of the population is going to survive, and natural selection is going to take care of the other side.
Oh, yeah.
But you can't apply it to individuals, because if you apply it to individuals, then you're into social Darwinism, and then you're into something that is simply not true. And that's not me attacking Darwin. It's Darwin. Darwin made it abundantly clear how he meant for his theory to be applied.
Yeah. Well, also, I like to point out, the Republican mindset was that of the Neanderthal mindset, and look what happened to them.
They died out.
Yeah. It was the modern humans that were collective, in groups. We're all in this together. And look what happened to us.
I know. And that's, that's why I keep saying we are, at essence, a clannish, tribal animal. There's no such thing as a lone wolf.
No, there isn't.
In most primitive tribal societies, the worst thing that can happen to you is to be shunned or exiled from your group, because that is a guarantee. It's a death sentence without the group having to bother to carry out the business of killing you, because trying to live in isolated fashion will do it very nicely. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, how did we get here from Reverend Moon?
Well, it all boils back...
Conversation to the radio, my friend. Conversation radio.
It all boils back to the annual. A lot of these organizations, what they're trying to do, whether it be gangs or churches, all that, is reign for supremacy and weaken government.
Yeah.
And government is the ultimate collective, whether it be on the community scale, on the national scale, or on the global scale.
Anytime you've got more than two people, you've got some level of government going on.
Oh, yeah. But they're trying to weaken government where it's more tribal.
They're trying to... I don't know if I would say tribal, Kevin. They are trying to weaken government so as to maximize their individual potential. These right wingers, and in particular, now I'm not talking about the average Joe out there who votes for Republicans because they tell him that Democrats hate Jesus. I'm talking about the ones who really, really have the bucks.
Oh yeah.
And they're just trying to maximize their tribe, and their tribe, as I've said in the past, is not brown or white or black or yellow or red. It's green. And they're maximizing the influence and the power of the green people.
Oh yeah. And you got to look at the decline of the Roman Empire. And that's what the patricians ended up doing, is, building their own private little kingdoms in the frontier states. The best real estate was around the Mediterranean, of course. Mm-hmm. And as you went further out to Germany, to Britain, though it was more the hinterlands and stuff.
But there was still a living to be had.
Huh?
There was still a living to be had.
Yeah. Well, but it was a fiefdom. They broke away from Rome, which was the center of government, and they kept on undercutting government because of lack of tax money getting in. It came to a point where Rome was bringing everything in but shipping nothing out but soldiers. And that's what we're doing. We're consuming everything, but putting nothing out but the military.
Well, supporting our military has been it's about the only industry we have left in this country that, to at least some majority extent, is still in this country.
And that's changing, too.
Sure it is.
Okay. Because the military is becoming more and more privatized.
Hey, we're giving we gave a $300 million contract to a 22-year-old dude.
Yeah.
Who bought ammunition for the Afghan armed forces and police from rotting warehouses in Albania.
Whew. Oh, yeah.
I'm still not over that story, Kevin. I'm just not over it. I'm not over it.
I wish I was that smart at 22.
He wasn't smart. He had a Craigslist and a MySpace, and no, they just found him. Somebody Googled arms dealer on MySpace.
Yeah.
And, you know, bang, there was Ephraim.
Yeah, well, hell, you know, I'm at the point where I'm still at the point, and I hate being this now, but I'm getting so frustrated at the point where I'm more and more getting tempted to look out for self, because if not, no, who else? And I'm trying not to go there. I really am.
Well, but you got to keep you going.
Yeah.
And I think your basic inclination toward trying to be decent to your fellow human beings will still shine through. But you've got to get rice in your bowl first.
Yeah, and I truly hope so. You know, I truly hope so. You know, I knew this transition in my life wasn't going to be easy, but I'm going through some bumpy roads. You know, as you know, people out there know my story.
Yeah,
and I'm experiencing it because it's like part of the reason why I decided to go into teaching was to put less cannon fodder out there. But then again, it's kind of like, a lot of them are putting themselves out there willingly. You know, we don't have to.
They don't need the help. Right.
Yeah, we don't have to have a draft anymore. They're registering still.
I know. Hey, Kevin, I got to roll on, brother, but it's awful good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you.
All right, take care. Bye now. Our buddy Kevin up in Brooklyn. Email rolling in from our pal Cindy. Hey, Bob. Hey, Cindy. Oh, yes. The booing of the baseball game at the baseball game was cool. The Mooney program Mark did, fantastic. I can't help wondering how old people are when they discover this. I was well aware of Moonies and their Goonie cloners back in the early 1980s when they were first foisted by Ronald Reagan. They were the first example of the underground church group raising billions of hidden dollars for the Ripornicans. Ooh, there's a new word, everybody. Ripornicans. Which gives rise to something else. Wait a minute. The evangelicals? We could start, given their propensities, we could start referring to them as the pornigans? Cindy, you've started something. Anyway, she says, the model has been running long and strong since the Reagan election, and the question is, are we ready to take it down? And that is the question. As to when people became aware of them, I remember hearing about them in the late 70s. And by the time I took my high school trip, spring break trip, that took me out of the country, and we flew out of Kennedy, I knew what I was looking at when the little guy came up to me and said, would you like to buy an American flag pin for world peace? And you know what? That's also where the American flag pin business began. It began with Reverend Moon and his Moonies, and it also began, to a certain extent, with Jerry Falwell. Would you like to give a contribution of whatever change you have to support freedom? I have an American flag pin for you. And at the tender age of 15 or 16, whatever it was, I was a smart aleck then, too, because shortly thereafter, I was approached by a Krishna who wanted me to buy his flower for universal love there in JFK. So I got both the flower and the pin. And the airport was crawling with them, Moonies and Krishnas. And so when so the next time when the Mooney when the Krishna came up to him, would you like to buy my little flower? I hauled it, only if you'll buy my little pin, and I held up my American flag pin. A little bit later, a Mooney walks up to him, will you buy my little pin? Only if you'll buy my little flower. During the layover we had waiting for our transcontinental flight, or no, transatlantic flight, I had several opportunities to be a smartass with the Moonies and the Krishnas, to the point that they got to where they were going the other way when they'd see me coming. It was gratifying. It was mean, but gratifying. And our buddy Marty says, with regard to John Miller, he says he was probably told by ESPN, ABC, Disney to be very nice and respectable regarding Chuckle Nuts. I'll have to fire off an angry email to John about it. And yeah, John Miller, as Marty notes, did used to be the voice of the Baltimore Orioles as well. A query. The only thing that has historic precedence for maintaining educational achievement standards or economic positioning in a family is when the family is stuck together tightly and maintained within a tightly formal society system. When hard times hit a family, everyone fans out to make do. That fanning out reduces the achievement level of the family. But the question enters the picture, who has the right to tell a person born that he or she must remain part of the family? Is not their life itself a personal gift to them as an individual? Isn't the joining and staying within the family structure something that is best done by free choice? Are they not free to go west if they choose? Americans have fanned out, and the centralized family is a myth. It is a myth from the old world and has not caught on here because of our nomadic nature as a people. Americans are adventurers. And is it not the responsibility of each individual to continue their education as long as they live in one way or another? If they don't, their brain will actually atrophy. I believe Americans are lazy and spoiled, and that they enjoy doing drugs and alcohol and don't want to be educated. They rather enjoy putting the responsibility for the hard things on someone else, or someone else, and claim they're not made out to do that job. Jobs like medicine, astronomy, physics, engineering, teaching, society building work. America is currently packed with loafers. And I'm sorry to pop your bubble, but sports feeds this mental retardation. It is but an excuse because it makes intellectual laziness socially acceptable. Yeah, see, I don't necessarily buy into all of that. It took a certain... The reason you get large families in 18th and 19th century America is because it takes a good bit of workers to bring in enough food to get any given family unit through the winter. Plain and simple. But that level of labor was so intensive, and the people in such states of isolation, that literacy can go by the boards. Now, you know, they would have knowledge of maybe pick up some knowledge of medicinal plants or medicinal trees, or maybe pick up some knowledge of when to plant what, or what was good to eat and what wasn't in the wild. But they were also feeling pressure from the people that they were invading, namely the Indians. My bubble is not burst by reflections upon sport, because sport and play are one of the things that defines humans as compared to so-called lesser, and I don't buy into the lesser thing, lesser animals. And we find out that we have greater kinship with the so-called lesser animals when we find out that they do two things. They either make tools, or they play, or they do both. Every species on Earth, virtually, has a propensity for altering its reality. Whether it's birds eating berries and flying into windows, or the various and sundry leaves that animals will eat and get themselves a little, you know, a little bubble off plum. I don't think that you can say that somebody who likes to sit down with a cocktail is somehow slacking on society, because I know lots of engineers who do. And I know a couple of astronomers who do. And a couple of physicists who do. Now, do they, you know, do they get the screw top wine and hang out with the boys under the bridge? No. And that is the actual line of demarcation, as far as I can tell. Now, there's no getting around the fact that professional sports, as we understand them, which began with the first professional sport in this country, I suppose, was either horse racing or baseball. But when baseball arises, it also arises at the same time as the great period of the genesis of labor unrest in this country. And it is true that professional sports served as an outlet for people who might otherwise have been marching in the streets and demanding fair wages. No getting around that. But am I going to indict some guy for sitting down and watching a baseball game, or some woman for sitting down and watching figure skating? No, I'm not. The indictment comes when the demon box stays on 24/7, and it is and it becomes, rather than in some level of entertainment, more of an altar for the electronic family. And family, you know, family has been, at least as I experienced it through the history that was passed on to me, more cohesive in the past. But it was that way by dint of necessity. My great-grandfather died at home. At least two of them did. In either their own home or the home of one of their children. Because that was one of the good things that we tended to take care of our elders once upon a time. Now we warehouse them. And frankly, I think the nursing home industry is one of the greatest barometers of our national failings that exists. Because the economy is such that we can't stay home, we don't have anybody who can be home to help care for our loved ones in their old age. And we think primarily about ourselves. Oh, yeah, I can't quit my job to go, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's true. But we don't look at why it is that we can't. And so what else do we have to look forward to than to be warehoused in our own right? And to have our property taken from us, instead of passing it on to the next generation, to have our property taken from us to cover the cost of our care, as is the nature of Medicare's cost recoupment program. Just is. So, you know, there's really, it's possible to make some generalizations about it, and a lot of them are true, but they are not universally so. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Susan.
Hey, Susan, what's up?
Well, for one thing, I take umbrage at email.
How so?
Do you have any idea how many hours I spend on this computer working for the horn?
A lot.
Yeah.
And for the same pay everybody else is getting. Oh, believe me, I know. I think about it every day.
Yeah, and that's not an indication of laziness in my book. When I'm not working on the horn, I have my nose in a book. I don't watch television. Why on earth would I want to watch that babble box?
Well, where are you taking the umbrage?
Well, according to the email, Americans are lazy. All they want to do is sit in front of the TV set and veg out and
But I think a lot. I think that can be said for a lot of Americans, Susan. I mean, all you have
some
to do.
Some of them, yes.
No, I'd say more than some. Take a look at the Nielsen numbers for American Idol or Dancing with the Stars. But on the
I'll
other,
give you that.
On the other hand, I also won't take away from people who, when they come home from working this their second job or their third, remember that's uniquely American, working three jobs now, Susan. Who don't have the time, inclination, or patience to sit down and devour a chapter of Dickens's Bleak House. I was compelled to read that book once, and once was all it was ever going to get out of me. Because Charles Dickens was paid by the word. So
and, oh, boy, did he ever churn them out.
Sure. 5 pages on a vein in a leaf. 2 chapters just to finish the leaf.
I consider people like me, like you, and others like us, to be the yeast.
Well, I hope we are. I hope we are. That's the whole, and I think that's what draws us together in this community that we call the Horn.
Yeah, I did have a, I was sitting here listening, and I have thought, you know, your earlier caller was, I just went blank, and I can't remember his name.
It's Kevin.
But I looked at my phone. You were discussing Darwin. And has it occurred to you that the biggest social Darwinist, which to me are is a dirty name, on the planet are the Republicans?
Sure they are. Sure they are. Because they're operating off the same playbook as the social Darwinists of the early 20th century. And you know what that got us?
Yeah, the Nazis.
Yeah. But social Darwinism is in and of itself flawed.
Oh, God, yes.
Because, again, as I understand it, and I may be speaking, you know, not just ex cathedra, but ex the yard in front of the cathedra, it doesn't fit. It doesn't work inside the model. And it never was intended to do so. Social Darwinism is something that was taken and perverted. If that makes any sense.
Well, I think Darwinism was perverted to fit the into social Darwinism. I know Darwinism itself only works with huge populations. Species population. You know, it's like expecting what happens to you or me to determine what happens to the entire species. Don't work that way.
True.
Your explanation of the one-legged was beautiful. I loved it. You know, the one-legged, the short-legged mutation. That was one of the most succinct explanations of natural selection I've heard in a long time.
Pretty viable, I'd say.
Because that's exactly how it works. But it only works on a species level. If it shows up in one animal, it's immaterial. Nobody cares, least of all Mother Nature.
Well, Mother Nature is notoriously uncaring.
Yeah, Mother Nature is a hell of a mother. She don't give a rip.
Yeah, she's got the maternal skills of a catfish. Okay, Wait. That was just a flippant smartass remark, Susan. Who am I to judge that? Okay, you know, if the right wing wants to talk about God. As, you know, the ways of God are many and mysterious. If you look at something like the Gaia theory of the planet and of the universe, it makes the deists and the monotheists' idea of a mysterious god look downright fathomable, because he's just playing chess.
Yeah.
The universe, however, is the most profound clock that ever existed. I mean, if you think about the wheeling of the galaxies and yada yada, and you try to expand your mind out to that place where the human mind can't go, you get a picture of the teeny tiny turning gears inside a clock.
I wish I could remember the author, but I read a book once. You know me in science fiction.
Sure.
Where the suns were sentient. Stars were sentient.
I think I ran across something like that one. Yeah.
And, you know, it just blew me away, because that just tilted the whole concept of, you know, your universe about 90 degrees.
I'd say that's pretty fair.
It's just tied into the Gaia theory and the whole nine yards, and whoa. If I ever can find that author, I'll email it to you, because it was a really good book.
You know, I had another one on my mind recently, just for the past couple of days, based on stuff that I've been reading and so forth. And I know my sister probably still has it, so I'll just have to bug her and get her to throw it in the mail. A little paperback from way back that I think I've mentioned in the past, called Where Late the Sweet Birds Sang. No, again, you know, science fiction.
What was it again?
Where Late the Sweet Birds Sang. And it's sort of a picture of societal collapse.
Uh-huh.
And I remember just being profoundly, profoundly struck by it when I picked it up at, you know, 16, 17 years old, whatever. So, you know, maybe put that on the list. You may even have it sitting on a shelf somewhere.
I probably do.
Because I seem to recall that in that genre, it received pretty good notice back in the day, so to speak. Susan, we're at the top of the hour. I'm gonna run on. How's Donald?
Well, I got him home, and he's on oxygen 24/7 for a while, but he's trucking along.
Thank heaven for small favors. Well, no, thank you. It's so easy. That stuff just insinuates itself into our consciousness. Susan, have a wonderful evening, and thank you. Thank you for what you do. All right, will do. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And we'll take a little musical interlude for the top of the hour. If you're on hold, please stay that way. If you want to jump into the conversation, I hope you know that you are more than welcome to do so. 304-658-3333. 877-443-2366, toll-free if you need us to carry the freight. That's 877, the numeral 4, head-on. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. One day left to meet the March goal. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be right back.
Oh! It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
I'd say this Monday night edition is off to a rousing, roaring start. What about you? Like I said, jump right in, although I've got some stuff that I'm pretty hung up on getting to tonight. I'll find a way. By the way, just a programming note for you, Peter Godbold's not live tonight. He will, even if the creek does rise, be live tomorrow evening. I expect we'll have a horn section and, of course, all foxed up with John Fox coming your way at midnight Eastern time. And having mentioned John Fox, I would be remiss if I did not mention that latest addition to the full multimedia horn experience, which is, in fact, the horn forums at headonradionetwork.com/forum. John and our forum moderator, Lottie, and several other of the people who make a lot of this happen put in a whole bunch of work getting that live as of last Friday, and I announced it on the program then. But let me encourage you again to take advantage of these fora. Sorry, I'm a stickler for good Latin. One forum is a forum. Several of them are fora. You can thank me later. But at any rate, stop on by. It is, like everything else on the horn, free. If by some by some motivation you are able to contribute and make the horn continue, help to keep the horn going as we continue building and continue to grow, then so much more is the better. And we would sincerely appreciate it. I said, you know, one day left? Not hardly. There are parts of the globe where March is over. Even here, there are 5 hours left. On the West Coast, there are 8 hours left for us to go approximately, under the best of circumstances, $600 before April comes and we get into an even deeper hole. One of these days, we're not going to be able to shout out of the hole. But, you know, we'll deal with that when that time comes. And we'll keep going the best that we possibly can. But do go over and avail yourself of the fora. Because, there's just not a lot of free opportunities left anymore. And we hope, we hope you enjoy them, hope you appreciate them. And hope you use them and for their intended purpose, and that is the fostering of further dialogue and discussion. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
You got Andrew.
Hey, Andrew, how are you?
Hey, I'm around. I know I've been gone a while.
Yeah, we figured you'd send up smoke signals or something if there was trouble.
Well, there's a little bit of trouble here and there, you know. We got my company got bought out, so, you know.
Oh, no.
Transition now. Yeah, so it's still up in the air. So, you know, just been pretty much trying to focus on that and tidy things up, you know, for the transition. But I just wanted to call and say, you know, I've got to eat a little crow. The last time I talked to you, I was talking about Barack. He didn't have a chance, and you know what? To get the presidency, to get the nomination, and I guess I have to eat a little crow on that one.
It's not done yet, but go ahead.
I'm glad to see that he's come as far as he did. Yeah, I had issues with him, same as I had issues with Hillary, but it's a little heartwarming to see that he's gotten this far.
It is. And, you know, just a quick little memo, stay out of bowling alleys, Barack. But, you know, we don't need to give them images. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I know.
I remember John Kerry windsurfing and what that just.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but no, it is gratifying to see. And yeah. Frankly, I think he'll do about, you know what, a million times better job in the Oval Office than John McCain ever could. And yeah. I think you know, I frankly, on the grand, you know, on the whole, I think he's probably better than Hillary at it.
Yeah, that's my point exactly. And what really has me disturbed is the whole Fed action, what they're doing with the regulation. It seems like they're trying to privatize the regulators.
Oh, what? You know, I read that earlier today, and it, you know, it. I know.
It just makes you want to pull your hair out. And it's like, now you have these Wall Street guys talking about, oh, this is good. And I'm like, since when is the way they're painting it as more regulation? Since when Wall Street wants more regulation?
Wall Street wants more regulation when the more regulation that Wall Street is getting is no regulation.
Exactly.
I know that sounds just a little bit twisted, but that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, and it's just like, and they're trying to blame the little guy, of course, instead of these big investment bankers who were packaging these crap loans, which they knew they were crap, and they were, you know, borrowing against that, and, you know, 10 times over, and it's just, what a Ponzi scheme. It just pisses me off so bad, even though I don't have a whole bunch of money in the game, all right, because I'm just, you know, regular Joe Blow American out here trying to struggle living paycheck to paycheck, but we end up paying for their malfeasance and fraud. And it just pisses me off. And it's like, you know, the American people are seeing it because I talk to a lot of Republicans up here because that's where I live, and where I live in New York. I don't live in New York City. So it's like they see that they're getting taken for a ride, and they're pissed. And, you know, a lot of them are in trouble now. Like we've been talking for the past, like, 3 years, a lot of these people up here, in New York, and where I'm at, I'm in Dutchess County, New York. I'm 2 miles from FDR's estate. And they are, a lot of people are in trouble up here. I mean, they're having a hard time putting, you know, groceries, food on the table.
Yeah, when you say trouble, you're not talking about, oh, well, you know, we may have to cut back on some of the premium channels on the TV.
Well, they're cutting the cable off altogether.
That's what I mean. The real, you know, real problems that relate to the continued feeding and sheltering of a significant number of people in our country.
Yes.
And John McCain says, let them eat cake.
Basically. And, you know, I know a lady, she's she doesn't know where she's going to get her next mortgage payment. I mean, like, she's 20 years in. And, you know, she voted for Bush twice. And when I was told her the second time, I was like, don't vote for him. I'm like, don't vote for him. I'm like, what are you doing? You're voting against your best interest. Now she sees. And now you have this woman who voted for Bush twice saying she's going to vote for Obama if he gets denied.
I've gotten an email from a dear friend of mine who happens to be profoundly conservative in Pennsylvania, Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, well, if the nominee is Barack, I will vote for Barack ahead of McCain.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, you yay you, good for you.
Good for you, but then it's like, what took you so long?
There's a very fundamental human inclination, Andrew, to say, thank you very kindly for closing the barn door now that all the blooming horses are gone.
Exactly. I mean, they stole the treasury. I mean, they've broken our military. We got this big embassy over there in Iraq. It's like $500 million. What is it, up to $700 million now?
$750 million last I read, close to it.
It's like, now, a question I have for Barack is like, what are you going to do there? If you're going to pull the troops out in 16 months, okay, what's going to happen to that embassy? You know, what you going to leave it? You better, you know, what a waste of money. I mean,
but, you know,
for the Iraqi people, I guess, but...
Andrew, there's a larger question, and it's one that... And it's not one of those that you'd be afraid to ask because you'd be giving the right wing too much fodder. It's just one that I don't think most of America is tuned into yet, and that is this. Okay, you're going to pull the troops out. What are you going to do about the mercenaries?
Yes. Well, I was listening to another show this weekend, and they had one of Barack Obama's political advisors on there. He was a brigadier general. I forget his name, escapes me, but... He was saying that they in relation to the number of troops that are being pulled out, because there are a lot of them are doing, you know, some of them are doing the security work, but a lot of them are doing what our military should be doing, like, you know, doing the kitchen and doing trucks and drivers and all of that stuff.
Yeah, those guys I'm not so worried about, because, yeah, they'll come out when the work is gone, but it's the hired guns that sort of give me the night sweats.
Yes.
Because those guys are going to come back and want the same kind of work here at home, because you don't just walk away from 115, 150 large a year and say, well, you know, that's the end of it, and I'll wait till the next war.
True. But I think that embassy is nothing but an oil headquarters. That'll be a headquarters for all the oil execs. And you probably see a lot of those mercenaries go over there, and they'll be guarding that embassy. Because that is nothing more than oil central. So they can run their operations and control Iraq's oil.
I don't know. Maybe we could sell it to ExxonMobil on the cheap and just have done with it, Andrew.
Yeah, maybe.
And then they can... And then
no,
they can
not getting up that oil. Regardless, if we pull the troops out or what, they're going to get that oil. Because that's what they went over there for anyway. So...
I think you're correct in every aspect. But it's not going to be a pretty sight, and it's not going to be easily accomplished.
No. It's not going to be just like you withdraw them and they come home and that's it. But
yeah, everybody get on the plane. We're leaving now.
Yeah. Okay, it's up to you. And what pisses me off even more is how the Iraqi people got to stand up and take care of their country, and you know they got to take action. I'm like, you morons went in there. You built the place. You built it in the first place. It wasn't even their fault. You went over there on a lie. Told them you were going to liberate them, and you break it, and now you're saying all the chaos and everything that's ensuing is their fault. No, you planted the seed, and now you're going to blame them for them having all the civil war that's brewing now?
I don't think George Bush meant it this way, but truly what's going on is a defining moment. Because,
yeah.
But you know, what kind of a question is that to ask a member of the American military, you know, to fight on one side? I mean, this isn't even Sunni versus Shia anymore. This is Shia versus Shia.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you flip a coin? And while the supposedly the Iraqis have been running this battle, well, now the Nouri al-Maliki side has American air support, if you noticed.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, I thought mission was accomplished, George. You know? And
major combat operations have ended. I could swear I heard that, Andrew.
Yeah, I thought I heard that too, somewhere. Maybe it was a figment of my imagination, but it's just disgusting. And the situation our country is in, like, economic tatters. I mean...
Do you ever get to that point where you wonder if we get to January without the balloon going up?
Well, yeah. I always think about that all the time. I think about that all the time. I'm like, will we have an election? You know, it's bad to think like that, but you can't put anything past these guys. I mean, you can't.
I think we do so at our own peril.
You can't rule anything out because, I don't know. I'm really at a loss right now. And maybe that's why I haven't been calling in besides the whole work issue, but I am really at a loss.
Well, let me put this question to you, if you don't mind. At this point in time, are the American people in such a state that they would be diverted by a brand spanking new, fresh little war, say maybe against Iran?
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that we'd tune into our TVs and watch the late night infrared footage on CNN and run out into the parking lots and say, you know, USA, 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 and all the stupid garbage that got done at the beginning of this last fiasco, and just sort of forget that, I mean, would the people who are being foreclosed on forget that they're being foreclosed on, and would the people who aren't just forget about the people who are? Because if you answer that question in the affirmative, then I guarantee, just about rock solid lead pipe cinch guarantee you that there will be an attack on Iran sometime between now and November.
I won't rule it out because, you know, the people are still, yeah, they have all these other issues on their mind, but it's like, I don't know. I don't know if they could be goaded. I would want to say that they wouldn't, But I can't rule that out. I don't know. The jury's out on that one. I mean, I talk to people, and some people still believe the administration, you know, jingoistic garbage on Iran. And it's like, I don't know. Jury's out. I mean, they watch TV. People still watch TV. They get them all their information from TV still, the majority of people.
Because there's Dick Cheney last week repeating the same, and I mean almost word for word, the same tired, dirty, filthy, rotten lies that they said about Iraq, and he just puts it out there and does, you know, and does it with a straight face.
Yeah, with impunity. With impunity. Just, hey, this is how it is, you know.
Do you think that Cheney and Bush believed John Conyers, or believed him when he said, if they attack Iran, there will be impeachment hearings? Or does that just mean that they have to attack Iran, oh, you know, October 23rd?
I don't know, but Saudi Arabia is they're taking radioactive fallout precaution. So, I don't know.
Yeah, and only after the meeting with Dick Cheney.
Yes. So, Dick's over there. He was sowing his seeds all over, telling them, giving everybody the heads up, pretty much.
Yeah, and you know, I just look at it, hunker down, America. They're going to do it again.
Basically. As I said, the jury's still out, but it's 50-50. Right now, it's 50-50.
I mean, you've got the Bush administration saying, you know, that Europe needs to contribute more NATO forces to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, I wonder why that is. Maybe it's because most of our effective forces are being wasted in Iraq, but...
This is weird. It's just... And another thing. Bush and them, you know, they only have so many months left. Okay, so if they start, you know, another fire, they start another war in Iran. You know, hey, the heck with it. If they give up power, they'll be out of power and say, whatever. You know?
That fits into the model, too, because you got to remember that Poppy Bush started Somalia and tossed it over to Bill Clinton and said, hey, have fun, son.
Yeah, have it. And Bush already said, hey, Iraq's not going to be solved on my watch, so why not start one in a war with Iran? Why not? I won't have to deal with it, you know?
Especially if they perceive that they're handing it off to a Democrat.
Yes, and they can blame the Democrats when it all really moves to hell in a handbasket.
And then, you know, George picks up the phone and calls Jeb and says, I've got it all laid out real nice for you in 12.
Yep.
Don't screw it up.
Yep. And they'll blame the meltdown of the economy on the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they're doing right now with the Fed pumping all this money in. They're just propping it up until, you know, January 21st, 2009. And then... the bottom will fall out. You know, all their friends who got their money out and converted to whatever currency they wanted, euros or what have you. And they said, see, when you have a Democrat come in office, see what happens?
Well, exactly.
And all the dirt was done by them.
these guys are street punks and they behave like that. It's not like they haven't done it before. It's 2008, and if you hear the name Jimmy Carter mentioned, what do you hear? Oh, he was responsible for the worst inflation in history.
Exactly.
When everything that Jimmy Carter had to deal with, he was handed by a gang of Republican thugs.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing you can say about Republicans: they're consistent.
They are, and the thing.
Wars.
Yeah, they start wars, start hand wars. Them off, you destroy economies.
Yeah. Yep.
And then blame the guy who's trying to fix it. See, that's the critical thing, Andrew. Jimmy Carter was trying to find a way out of the mess.
Yeah, he was. And when he put those solar panels up on top of the White House, that was one of the best things that was putting us on a good path. If we could have got off the ground then, we wouldn't be in any of the messes that we have now. Imagine if we had Democratic presidents that wanted to do the right thing. Since Jimmy Carter was in office.
You know, you might be surprised, Andrew, but I do sit around thinking about stuff like that. I think about a world with a President Mondale in it. I think about a world with a President Dukakis in it.
Yeah.
And I can't get around the fact that it's a better United States, and it's a better world.
Yeah. It would have been a better world. It would have been would have been a lot better world.
Because if you'd had two terms, if you'd had 2 terms of Jimmy Carter followed by Walter Mondale, nobody ever would have looted the retirement system of this country to prop up phony up the numbers on Wall Street.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't have been an 87 crash.
Nope. Which we're still paying for.
Sure we are. Sure we are.
Your tax returns a little bit less every year because of that.
We just go a little further into the ditch, a little further into the ditch, a little further into the ditch.
That's it. Well, Bob, it was nice talking to you. Say hi to Agnes.
I sure will, Andrew. And I, you know, is everything okay? I mean, with the transition, is everything going to be all right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know how it goes. You know, you don't know until they get in. But, you know, I got word that I was safe, but who knows? You know.
Yeah.
It could ever come.
Well, we'll be thinking of you, and like I said,
I'll find something else.
when we don't hear from somebody after a while, we begin to fret and, you know, send up a smoke signal, drop an email, just, you know, hey, I'm here, whatever.
Okay, we'll do.
Because, you know, we're like the internet mommy or something, because we worry. Andrew, take care, my friend.
All right, take it easy.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
What do you say? I mean, based on what Andrew was talking about, what do you say to somebody who, well, I voted for him twice, but I ain't voting for... I'm going to vote for Obama if it's Obama. Glad the light's on. Sure could have used a little bit of light in the darkness in 2004 there, but, you know, sorry you couldn't be on board for that. Sorry you hadn't wised up yet. Sorry it hadn't gotten painful enough for you then. I guess that's counterproductive, but, man, it's hard not to say. You know what I mean? Hi, who have I got?
Bob?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Sandra. How you doing?
Doing good. How about you?
You know, I got my little niece is at the park, so I'm just sitting here staring. But I called because earlier you were talking about, what was his name? Joe Bajic?
Joe Bajic, yeah.
Bajic, yeah. No, I was saying because I read some of his stuff. I mean, it's quite... You know, I mean, from a working class perspective, at least white working class, you know, he really sort of nails it. I never read anything like it in my life. But the thing that really I remember stuck out was he was talking about that poor Linda England or whatever her name was, one of them people who...
Yeah, Linda England, sure.
Right. And, you know, what he said about her, he said, you know, she was, you know, had a dream of being some sort of storm chaser. And he was just... using that as an example of how far out, you know, some of his, as he considers her one of his peoples, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Just don't have a clue, and, you know, how much of that society is just, they don't even know if they're coming or going.
Ben.
And I just thought, you know, he just paints this really disturbing, you know, image of just sort of the working class whites in this country, and I just... Yeah, you know, you don't get to see or hear much about it. He's like one of the few commentators, you know, I've ever read that even touches on it, you know?
And you know what? It's pathetic, Sandra. And I can guarantee you he is speaking 100% full gospel truth.
Well, I mean, there's like the, you know, the sort of underclass of black folks, you know, the similarities, you know, it's just sort of, that's why I was drawn to it, because it's like, yeah, I know those people. So, you know what I mean? It's just sort of across the board. But unfortunately, white working class people seem to think that they're something that they're not, whereas the black people ain't as delusional.
Well, I was gonna say. So you're saying the black community is a little bit more reality based?
Well, I think that, you know, because of the history, I'm not saying that people aren't, you know, missing things in that community, but there is, you know, black people don't set the terms in this country, so you're not going to fall, you know, you're not going to fall prey to that, like what I see as sort of poor white people. They seem to embrace white supremacy, but they don't really get much out of it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, they don't understand that they don't have any. Well, if you go back to, oh boy, this is esoteric. that conversation that's recorded in Hemingway's A Movable Feast between him and F. Scott Fitzgerald, where Fitzgerald says, the rich are very different from you and me. It's hard. It's and a greater truth has never been spoken. And that's the thing that's hard to get across to lower class, poor working white folks, is that you're not, you would not be welcome at the cocktail party of the white millionaires.
And not only that, but see, they're thinking that 30,000 is middle class, which is what, you know, that's where I start freaking out, because I'm like, oh my Lord, you know, the term middle class has been so bastardized, you know, people don't have a clue what it means anymore.
30,000 was middle class 40 years ago.
Well, yeah, because 30,000 is what, unfortunately, oh, probably at least 40% of people in this country make. You see what I'm saying? Now.
Sure.
And they're sitting around thinking that they're middle class, and it's like some sort of, you know, bad joke, a real bad joke, because 30,000 isn't even, it's poverty, you know?
I was looking at the numbers just the other day, Sandra, with the Children's Health Insurance Program. We wanted to expand in West Virginia up to, I think, 400% of the poverty level for a family of four. 400% of the poverty level for a family of four in West Virginia is deemed to be $60,000 a year. 200% of, and I'm probably getting the math wrong, but I'm trying to remember the numbers. The initial number was that 200% of the poverty level for a family of four in this state is $40,000.
Well, no, but see, that's all just a bunch of BS. It all should be sort of pushed down, because $40,000 is piss. You understand what I'm saying? It's a joke.
Yeah, it is.
One person in this country, let alone a family of four.
Well, yeah,
I mean?
All
I mean,
we got, yeah,
much?
All we got to do is run the numbers. Let's see here, $4,000 a year for family medical coverage. Is that fair?
Oh God, yeah, if you're lucky.
Yeah. Now let's add in the auto insurance. That's a good $1,500. So we're at $4,500,
yeah.
And that's for one car. If you're a two car family with mommy and daddy going to work, then you're at $3,000, so we're at $7,000 out of that $30,000 salary that's going to get a $10,000 lopped off of it for taxes at the front end.
Right, okay. And if you have to, when you start factoring the housing costs, say you're renting and you're paying $1,200 a month, what the hell is that? That's all your money, right?
Yeah, you're broke. You're broke, and we haven't even gotten to groceries.
That's what I'm saying, so it's just kind of, you know, it's just a joke, because, you know, I'm single, and I've made $40,000 a year, and, you know, I do okay, but really, I live in California, man, it's not much.
No, because in California, a three-bedroom, 1,200-square-foot house on a postage-stamp-sized lot's a million-dollar home.
Well, no, and listen, I think the statistics is up to like 47% of Californians, you know, have to rent, and they're paying like 58% of their wages to pay for that. So, it's, you know, back in the day, it used to be 25%. You know, that's like some sort of something that's in science fiction now, those sort of ratios of people's income. Most of it's going to housing, and it doesn't leave much for anything else, you know?
I think the number that I once heard from a banker, Sandra, was that if you wish to buy a house, you should be prepared to put a third of your annual income into home equity. Now, that's just fantasy land anymore.
Well, no, and it's just what you used to do is, like, you know, when I was growing up, you know, my folks are like, you don't do second mortgages, you know, let's have house fall apart. You see what I'm saying? It just wasn't even a factor. You don't, once you start making payments on that, you don't even think about taking another one out. You know, it's not, it just is a whole different mindset, you know?
Well, wasn't there a time in America when you retired your mortgage, when you called all your friends and neighbors over and had a big mortgage burning party? Remember?
Yeah, no, it's all, you know, yeah, you're like, hey, this is mine and mine. You know what I'm saying? Mine and my kids, and that's the end of that. You're not getting 50-year notes and, you know, interest-only things where your house is worth less than what you're paying, and so you just away like it's a car. That's what's happening now. I'll be honest with you. Folks are like, well, no, this ain't worth it, and they leaving. They literally are walking away.
I know what...
I hate to laugh, but listen, the banks can take care of it. Now you got, in California, you got pockets of homes, mini mansions, full of, you know, drug addicts, and it's crime written. Every other house is empty. I mean, it's totally changing the makeup of these neighborhoods. I mean, it's not funny, but it's the banks don't want them. They don't want to be landlords. You know what I mean?
No, they don't. But what they do want to do is wait. You know, Andrew told that story a few minutes ago about the lady that's got 20 years into her mortgage, and she's, you know, doesn't know where the next mortgage payment's going to come from. Those are the houses that the banks love to get, because there's all that equity in it that they can eat up. And
yeah, well, that's just evil.
Yeah, it is. And it's,
I mean, I just, yeah, I don't even know what to make of the sort of, you know, social type havoc that it's wrecking on people, because, you know, you're taught from day one that owning your home in America is your stake in this country. Because it ain't nothing else. You got the Bill of Rights, and maybe you got your home. But if you don't have any of those, well, this ain't nothing but, like I said, a big mall, America. It ain't nothing to it.
Do you remember, what was it, maybe three State of the Union addresses ago, Sandra, when George Bush got up on the podium and said, more Americans now own their own home than ever before in the history of the United States, and I did it all.
That's because it's been rigged. It was rigged and fooled all these people into thinking that, you know, thinking that they can own a home when it was all built on a wobbly house of cards. And now we got to sit here and look at these disgusting pigs bail each other out and shove that. I didn't want to start cussing. I'm sorry, Bob.
That's okay. I understand.
I won't. But, you know, they're just passing all this down. You know, it's becoming socialize the risk and privatize the profits, and they're just doing it in our faces. And these people here are sitting around doing what? Waiting for their digital conversion box? I mean, please, I need to know what's going on, because they should be in the streets. This stuff is off the hook. I mean, it's mad crazy.
Yeah, I want to see that. I understand it's a little vindictive on my part, but if anybody out there is going to be singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, I think it should be the CEO of Bear Stearns. But again, I recognize that that's mean-spiritedness on my part.
No, that guy needs a buckshot in the ass. I don't even, you know what I mean? It's like Marie Antoinette, the whole nine yards need to be playing out here, because these people are just disgusting. Where J.P. Morgan's going to give them $2 a share, they're whining, oh, no, we want more. Now they upped that to $10 a share. Is it being nationalized, like Rock? Whatever that is, bank in England, they nationalized that and kicked all them fools out. Are you going to see that happen here?
Not hardly.
And it's just disgusting, because I was really impressed that the Bank of England said, okay, well, that's fine, but this is now our bank, and they fired a whole bunch of them executives, because you can't have a run bank and reward people. You know, where is the moral hazard? You know, and in America, we have some sort of real sick type of capitalism here that is just, it's so blatant. This is what's really getting to me, Bob, is how blatant it is.
Yeah, it's up in your face.
And now they want to banish the SEC. You know, this BS that he's coming out. Now they want to even take more regulations away and pretend that they're regulating it more. You hear that line.
Yeah, right? but consider who these thugs are, Sandra. How long did you figure it would take before they came out and said, well, you know, the problem was we had too much regulation in the markets?
No, it's just like some sort of bad Orwell nightmare, and I thought my head was going to explode when I had to listen to that lapdog, you know, ex, I don't know what he used to work, Paulson, worked for one of those big brokerage houses.
Yeah.
I am sick to death of these people pretending to represent anything but their, you know, their Wall Street buddies, you know, and they're using huge amounts of resources to cover their asses. And for the life of me, you know, the Democrats are never anywhere to be found for the war, for this, for anything.
No, we just got to wait it out, Sandra. That's the thing. We just got to wait it out, because it's all gonna be rainbows and violets once we elect a president.
Oh yeah, what? President Obama, who met with the Wall Street people a while back and just sort of said, well, I know you want to do good for the country. You know, come on now. I'm not fooled or moved by that at all.
Sandra's mama didn't raise no dummy. Yeah, no doubt about it. See, that it drives me batty because some of this is fairly easily remedied by the American people themselves taking it from the bottom up and looking at candidates, standing there and waiting for them to say family values and then just say, never, no, shut up. Real solutions. No more family values. No more terrorists. What are you going to do? But we're so cowed by them. We've royalized them, haven't we, Sandra?
It's just, I don't know. I mean, I'm just sort of, every day it just seems to get worse as far as how these people are represented and how we're supposed to view them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I just don't, I mean, I don't, you know, you seem to have a good take on these people, but a lot of these talk show hosts actually are sort of talking about these people as if they offer some change.
On what basis? Sorry, I was getting a drink there. I had a piece of ice in my mouth. On what basis do they offer? Do they think that? I mean, I know it would be good to have 60 senators in the United States Senate who are at least on its face Democrats, and it would be good to have a big old honking majority in the House of Representatives. There's no doubt that would be better than what we've got, because maybe, you know, we could get something like, and you can't understate the value of, well, one of my favorite little pieces of legislation that got murdered in the last year, the Employees Free Choice Act.
Well, yeah, and that was just murdered without, you know, without any fanfare and no explanations to the zillions of people that it would automatically help. That's one of those bills that's pretty self-explanatory, you know what I mean?
The numbers are out there, and they're kind of irrefutable, that if that became law in the United States, millions and millions and millions of people, Sandra, would become union members. Now, how far would that go toward solving the health care crisis?
Listen, there's no arguing with that. Yet the Democrats couldn't, you know, pull it together to deliver that to the people.
They let it get killed in the Senate. Now, to be fair, there was never any doubt that George Bush was going to veto it. And we all understood that if it had been passed. But at some point in time, it's about you know, sort of getting your back up and making him do it.
Well, no, not only that, but just if it was passed by both houses, even if he does veto it, it sort of puts the Democrats in a forward position on something. You know what I'm saying? It leaves it out there, and you can feel that, well, once they consolidate a bit more, that's a sure thing. But the way they did it, you know, it's just cowering and they can't get it together. And, you know, it just shows that it's not a priority.
It was that particular act was filibustered in the Senate, and Harry Reid couldn't find it in himself to do anything about it, to threaten them, to make it unpalatable for them, you know, to make them at least think twice before filibustered the Employee Free Choice Act. He just couldn't do it. And that's, you know, we could sit here and identify problems. That's one of them. I personally think that Harry Reid has got to go.
Oh, no. He needs to go. And, you know, I'm at a loss as to who to replace him. Who do you suggest?
Chris Dodd?
Yeah, I suppose.
Even Reid's second in command, Dick Durbin. That guy's shown some spine from time to time. You know, he's next in line behind Reid.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, forget about Dick Durbin. I guess I was sort of put off because he said something that was straight up correct about Bush and their sort of Nazi ways, and because he used that term, he had to grovel. Remember that?
No, yeah, and that's the pause that I get when I suggest Dick Durbin. But you know what? even doing that, though, is better than, you know, Harry Reid standing up and saying, I don't like this bill. It's weak tea.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I mean, Durbin would be, anybody with a bit of fire would be better than this sort of queasling Reed. I can't handle him. I can't handle his whole high pitched voice. You know what I mean? I don't mean to go macho, but put some bass in your voice. I'm like, can we get a man up in there or something?
Yeah, I know. It's like having, you know, Steve Perry, you know, singing, trying to sing bass or something. I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, there are solutions out there, but the question is getting to the point where we can have the solutions.
No, there's plenty of solutions out there, but it's just the sort of personalities involved. It's like, you know, look at Mitch McConnell. That fool don't play. I hate his guts, but he don't mess. He will take charge and run it. And I'm like, what's up with that? Where is our Mitch McConnell?
Yeah, well, and where are the Democrats of yesteryear?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I mean, I just, you know.
As much as he drives me crazy, there was a time when Robert Byrd, if he wanted something, would get it out of you one way or the other.
Oh, please, I'll never get over when Robert Byrd made that speech before the war. It was amazing. Remember that? When
yeah.
He was saying exactly what would happen and, you know, reading Bush like there was no tomorrow. Now, don't get me wrong, I got issues with that old KKK fool, but, you know, he did do that one right.
And I got issues with him for the bankruptcy reform. I got issues with him for, well, how about Samuel Alito? I just refuse to get over Samuel Alito where Robert Byrd is concerned.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah, no. I mean, the Democrats, Mike Malloy, I think it was Mike Malloy who said that the reason why we have these Supreme Court people is because of the Democrats. You see what I'm saying? It
yeah.
has to do with the Republicans. The Democrats could have stopped it, and they didn't.
And, you know, we've seen that time and again. And the point, the question is, because what I suspect out of all this, Sandra, is that they really are hoping that all they have to do is wait out the Bush administration. And that's the carrot in front of our collective nose is that, well, you know, just let us have our power and then, we'll show you then.
Well, no, but I mean, I was thinking about a conversation you were having with, was it Andrew? Was that the last caller?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the whole notion of these people opening a new front on this war just terrifies me. And, I have a hard time imagining that they would, but then who knows, you know? And that's a really horrible thought. But I think, tying it back to the Democrats, the weakness that the Democrats show isn't really helping that cause. I think it opens the door for, you know, man or monkey to go ahead and order that, you know?
And that's the thing. You know, John Conyers said, well, I can tell you, if they bomb Iran, there will be impeachment.
Well, so we have to have more death and more misery? You know what I'm saying? I don't appreciate that comment from Conyers. He's bankrupt as far as I'm concerned, and I'd hate to say it because I've always been a fan. But please, they're going to nuke a country, then you'll impeach? Is this what I'm hearing? Is this the final solution?
Well, and it reminds me of when Bush would say, well, you know, we can't have a timetable because that'd tell them what our plans are. So, you know, that's what Conyers did. He said, you know, so now the Bush administration just knows that, you know, if they're going to nuke Iran, they need to do it in late October. Thanks.
Oh, God. You know, that is a horrific thought, but I mean, if some of these things you're talking about, it's all tied in because that whole statistics about, is it true that half of the people in America are like functionally illiterate? Have you heard that statistic?
Yeah, I have.
Where is that for real?
I haven't verified it, but I don't have a problem believing it, Sandra.
Well, the reason why I say that is because if that's the case, then it would go a long way to explain why these wars pop up and, you know, these horrible things that have happened recently.
Well, doesn't it make it just terribly, terribly easy to understand? I mean, you remember the photograph, the poster child for the right wing, the guy with the flag bandana do-rag on his head in the St. Louis Cardinals T-shirt holding up the sign that says, get real, you morons, or, you know, whatever, but M-O-R-A-N-S. Yeah, classic right winger. Can't spell moron.
No.
I mean, haven't you just kind of indicted yourself when you misspell moron?
No. And it is really quite hideous. You read some of the letters that people send out, and, you know, the whole thing is just incomprehensible writing, and it's all hate. And you're like, is this the level across the board with these people? And then you think, well, it's no wonder Rush can get all these weirdos to go vote for Hillary, you know?
And see, that's the thing. It's where they get their information. It's the control of the media. I mean, this is, to go for the classical reference, the political and cultural situation in the United States, Sandra, is a Gordian knot. It's a knot that's wrapped in so many twists and so many kinks that you can't find the place where you start unraveling it. And you know, the classic example from Alexander the Great is that, you know, he was challenged to unknot the Gordian knot. He walked up to it and took his sword and hacked it in two and said, "There." And you wonder if somewhere along the way, and I don't know where the hacking starts, and I'm not calling for any kind of violence, that's just an analogy, but there's got to be some sort of dramatic break with the status quo. And the dangerous thing, Sandra, is that we can either do it ourselves or we can have it foisted on us. If we have it foisted on us, it's going to be brutal.
Well, yeah, but it makes me think, though, if we do wake up one morning and find that they've, like, dropped low-yield nuclear weapons on a Muslim country, you know, I just wonder what people will do here. I wonder if they'll do a damn thing.
Wonder what the rest of the world will do.
Well, that's the issue.
I mean, I know that it'll be...
my head around that.
On Fox, it'll be played on an endless loop because there will be pool coverage footage of it. You know, with the green infrared light and the mushroom cloud going up over Boucher in the middle of the night, because, you know, we do that. We strike by night.
I know, but I'm still reeling at the fact that Saudi Arabia has been practicing. You heard about this.
Oh, yeah.
What to deal with, you know, whatever radiation-type fallout or whatever. And I was like, oh, my God, after that evil... Cheney was, you know, sulking around there, and now all of a sudden they're worried about fallout. It doesn't bode too well.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, on the one hand, you say, you know, maybe, you know, these are evil geniuses. You know, they're just keeping the saber rattling to keep the pot boiling. You know that. But that would, if they were a smarter bunch, I would credit them with that, Sandra. But these people are so just pig mean. All right, that. I know for a fact that George Bush is sitting in the White House, and from time to time he thinks, I really would like to see one of them things blow up.
Well, yeah, no, and it's easy to make that leap, because if Dick Cheney can say, so what, and they volunteer for 4,000 of our own going out like that, well, he really don't give a flying F about some Persians. You understand what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
They can practice their weaponry, you know, oh, all the more better. I mean, who knows what these people are capable of? I don't understand why this man is still among the living with all his heart attacks, but that's neither here nor there. But he's an evil son of a bitch.
Oh, he is.
Oh my God! I mean, I thought about it, but when I heard that whole interview and that whole,
yeah, and then to follow it up by saying, "Well, the president bears the greatest burden of our losses."
Well, yeah, you know, it's just like, where's the ice pick? You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly. It's just right through the eardrum, just done. You know, yeah.
Because it was just so stunning, and the thing is that. Everyone sort of, you know, if I mention it to them, they just sort of shrug, and they're like, oh, God, Sandra, you're going to have a stroke, you know, because you're so concerned about these things. I'm like, so I just want to shoot them, too, right?
Yeah, because it's like somebody's telling you to go home and put on Bobby McFerrin and don't worry, be happy.
Well, yeah, and it's just a bunch of, you know, and I just think, well, okay, you know, so I'll just, you know, call you up now and then and have some sort of...
I love it when you do, because, you know, you give me a little bit of reassurance, Sandra, because I feel like that I'm it's a little bit safer, because I'm not the only one sitting around here doing this. That's the therapy I get out of the horn, is just to be reminded that, you know, there's thousands and thousands of Americans and people who've never even heard the horn who are thinking this stuff. And,
well, yeah, no, you know, it's like you have to make that connection, because otherwise, you know, the asylum, you think about George Orwell and all these other people who went off the deep end and didn't understand why, you know. You know, I think about George Orwell a lot, you know, because I kind of read his biography and I've read most of his writings. And, you know, he was just fascinating, but he lost it, you know. He went insane.
And that happens to people, and that's why I think it's important that, you know, we talk about a lot of terribly, terribly serious stuff here, Sandra, but if we don't giggle along the way, we're toast.
Oh, no, you really do have to
And that's why I love Joe Bajan, you know, because as serious the stuff that he talks about is, there's always a giggle in there. And I was reading some of the back of the book comments and, you know, the sterling stuff from pretty highfalutin people. And then I just thought, you know what I like about this guy? He whistles past graveyards. And
yep.
And with what he's doing, he recognizes that it's his own and his own country's graveyard he's whistling past.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, he talks about, you know, what he calls his folks, but, you know, there's a lot of love in what he's talking about. Please don't get me wrong, which is what makes his stuff readable, because you know that there's a level of caring that you never get from the eggheads and the, you know, elites who peer in on us, and I do say us, now and then. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
I appreciate, you know, that's why I really quite like his musings, because it's coming from a place of concern and care, not of dismissal and disdain, you know?
And he reminds me that I need to be a little bit gentler sometimes, because it's real easy for me to look at the people who put George Bush in office and just write them off. But
yeah.
But they're people who've been horribly, horribly manipulated.
No, they've been had, you know?
Yeah, they have. Did you notice, I ran across one that just sort of made my eyebrows go up around the back of my skull when he pointed out the brand that there in his hometown of Winchester, Virginia, there's a brand spanking new Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson Memorial Center or Museum or whatever. And he said, and the Civil War cannon at the front of it is pointed ominously at the black neighborhood.
Oh, shut up. Listen, that is just unbelievable.
And only he would catch something like that.
No, but, you know, you got to laugh. That's, I don't even know what to say about that, except that the South keeps playing the Civil War, man. It don't never end down there, huh?
No, it does. I mean, you know those little tags that you can buy on the front and put on the front bumper of your car. You know, where for places where you don't have to have tags on the front and back. I remember early on being at gas stations all over Alabama growing up and seeing this, you know, little caricature of a Confederate soldier with the Confederate battle flag over his shoulder, and it says "Forget Hell." And
Wow.
Yeah, and there's so much truth in it. And it's as long as that's perpetuated, it maintains the separation between the people. And not just between black and white, but between rich and poor, or whatever passes for middle class and lower class.
Well, I know. I mean, I think the whole class thing is obviously where discussions should flow at this point. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I'm not going to say I don't, Obama, I'm sort of ambivalent of, but I have to say that one of his speeches, when he was talking about the economics, he at least ventured into some class analysis, which I was kind of surprised, and it made me think, well, no fool, you better back off or you won't get elected.
But and that did take some guts, and I find it very, very interesting that now Condoleezza Rice has decided it's okay for her to come out and talk about it. Because she's got to balance it.
She's a birth defect kid. I can't stand her. Oh God.
But you know, we've all had this running pool on, you know, who's going to be the vice presidential running mate for McCain. And you know, I was out there saying, man, it's got to be Huckabee. And there are other people saying, oh, you know, Mitt Romney would be pretty good. But you know, coming up from the back of the pack, Condoleezza Rice, man.
She made a visit to Norquist, you know, which apparently is where they all go to discuss their futures. So that girl, McNutt and that Condoleezza hair? No. That is a hideous ticket that really.
Hey, I tell you what, if you enjoy Condoleezza's hair, Sandra, if you've never been there. There is a blog out there called Princess Sparkle Pony.
Oh, no.
And the subtitle is, "We keep track of Condoleezza's hairdos so you don't have to."
Well, listen.
And it's precious. It's precious. I mean, it's a don't miss it blog.
Oh, God, no. Okay, I have to look that one up because, see, when she first came on the scene, you know, me and my mates was like, yo, what's up with the hair? It's turning. It goes outside D.C. That stuff turns. It's like Naparama. You know, get a weave. They didn't make enough money.
Oh, my God. I couldn't say any of this on the air in a million years, Sandra.
Well, I can, and I will.
Oh, I owe you. I owe you big time.
Okay, listen, you know what? I'm going to let you go because I'm laughing too hard. I can't handle it.
I'm about can't breathe, okay?
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye, Sandra. Oh, my God. Get a weave. Oh, mother. Okay, onward we roll. Hi, who have I got?
This is Ben Birch.
Hey, Ben, how you doing? I'll calm down in a minute. Sandra just kind of did me in.
Well, you know, I got something else to do you in. I know who the perfect running mate for McCain is.
Okay.
Her name is Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Ew, don't.
And here is my thought. Now, I have seen a lot of scorched earth rhetoric coming out of Hillary and her supporters. I mean, stuff that if she isn't the nominee will leave the Democratic Party in a very bad position to elect elect Barack Obama. And there's only one real good reason for doing such a thing other than spitefulness. And that is because you think you're going to get asked to be the number two on the other ticket. So if you already have decided that you're going to lose the nomination, and you don't care about what happens to the Democratic Party, clearly she doesn't, and you've got somebody who actually kind of likes you on the other side, because, you know, Hillary and McCain have gotten along very well together.
This is a nightmare scenario that would give me sweats at 3 a.m., Ben.
She can continue to pretend to be a Democratic candidate right up to the very moment that she in an absolute surprise that nobody sees coming, walks out onto the stage at the Republican convention with John McCain. And he grabs her by the left hand, and they hold their hands above their heads, in the, you know, above them in the center, and he says, "I'd like to present to you the next Vice President of the United States of America," and that would defeat the Democratic Party, because not only does he have Hillary Clinton, who has spent all this time damaging Barack Obama, but he has the first woman vice president. And, you know, down in redneck country, that's going to sit a whole lot better than the first black president.
But it's Hillary. I mean, they've had 15 years to hate her guts. They're going to heal that in a matter of weeks?
Well, they're going to justify it like all people do when they have something that they can't reconcile. You know, they make up little justifications for it. Well, it's really okay. She's just the vice president. The vice president doesn't ever get to do anything. Vice president just gets to sit there and bang the gavel in the Senate. It's really okay. And this will get our ticket elected, so we'll vote for it.
Yeah, but, I mean, they understand that McCain would be 80 at the end of two terms, and that the odds of him maybe dying in office aren't real great, and that's how they wind up with President Hillary. I mean, don't you think that right-wingers would just get the blind, shivering peach pit?
Right-wingers do whatever they're told to do. That's how they differ from Democrats.
Oh, wait a minute. Well, there's that. Ew. This is making...
They can sell this in 5 minutes, although it's actually very much impossible to convince them that Hillary isn't evil. If she's on their ticket, she becomes a necessary evil.
And the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Correct.
But wait, Ben.
Major screwing coming.
I'm just scared to death of what you're putting forward here. Do you honestly think that Bill would stand for that?
I think Bill will stand for anything that seems to push his legacy forward into the future.
But, I mean, the Democratic the DLC drops dead the minute that happens, and that's Bill's creation.
The DLC is dead anyway. If the DLC couldn't elect Hillary against a one-term unknown from Illinois, then they don't have anything. They've shot their wad. Their powder isn't dry. It's wet and it's useless.
When did this all sort of coalesce for you, Ben?
The other day when I started listening to some of the rhetoric about Barack's minister, and I realized if they continue with this, they're going to alienate people who aren't going to look any further than their rhetoric, and they're going to make it impossible to elect Barack Obama, and they know it. They know that they're going to leave things in a situation where if they can't get elected, then Barack can't get elected. And that seems to be their goal. I think it's ultimately racist. I think there's a lot of white people in this country and in this party who want to convince themselves that they really aren't racists, that they're really voting for Hillary Clinton because she's the best and the brightest and the smartest thing there has ever been coming down the pike, and plus she's a woman and women need to be elevated in our society and all these other things. But like I said, people find justifications for the unjustifiable when it suits their interests.
But don't you think?
And if their main interest is keeping a black man out of power, then that's what they'll do.
But wouldn't that be balanced far better with Condoleezza Rice?
Oh, no, 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 no. You see, first of all, the whole idea is to create a white ticket here in the eyes of the Republicans. The last thing they want is a black man, you know. I mean, I don't even know why they keep Alan Keyes around.
Well, I'll avoid saying anything that would get me in trouble.
the last thing any Republican wants is a black man in power over him at all, under any circumstances in any way. I have never met a lifelong dedicated Republican who actually wasn't a complete racist.
Well, you know, the GOP, such that it is terrified of anybody darker than Edgar Winter.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that if we do see a Hillary, a McCain-Hillary ticket, what we're going to see is some kind of slogan that is just going to make you think of Wallace. It's going to be something like, McCain-Clinton, while there's still time.
I was thinking, for the people, for the future.
No, while there's still time. Because that would sell with the section of the population I'm referring to.
Yeah, it would. And a lot of times...
Build a campaign based entirely on racism in this country and win. I'm convinced of that.
I won't fight you on that. I spend a lot of time saying, you know, pointing out some horrific scenarios, Ben, and saying, gee, I not only hope I'm wrong, I really want to be wrong. I really want this not to be right, Ben.
Me too. But you know, I just see it as a possibility. I think that as this progresses, you know, it's going to poison the well, certainly. You know, we can't have Hillary continue as she and her prosecutors.
See, the thing that makes this even conceivable inside my tiny mind is the presence of Joe Lieberman in all this equation.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, everybody's
Hillary
still pals.
And Joe have always been on the best of terms.
And,
you know, I mean, I have heard that the Clintons are the ones that suggested Lieberman to Gore.
Oh, Lord.
To balance out the ticket, you understand.
Yes, to balance. Right. Oh, mercy.
Well, have fun with that tonight, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, well, luckily I didn't have dinner before the show, because otherwise it would be, you know, wanting a return visit. That just, Ben, God, I... Okay, this is one of those moments where I hope the little wingnut lurkers aren't listening tonight.
Well, you know, every so often I will sit down and think, worse? How could things be worse? And then I come up with something.
And then the other side of your brain goes, you just had to ask.
Exactly right.
Here, try this on for size. Yeah.
You take care.
All right, see you, Ben.
Bye.
Bye. Your thoughts on that? I'd say that has to be the most terrifying thought of the. That's the most terrifying scenario I'd say in the last 6 months outside of nuclear war with Iran. What do you think? Share your thoughts. Get it. You know, if it's as terrifying to you as it is to me, get it out of your system before it works its way into your id and you wake up in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. having dreamed of it. Because that's one of those dreams where you're trying to scream and you just can't. Hi, who have I got?
Good evening.
Hey, David, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right. I listened to what Ben said, and I really got to say, oh, man, that's just too outlandish. I mean, first of all, you would tick off the primary supporters. Second of all, you would have a break in both parties, and they wouldn't know what to do, and everyone would just stay home. Or no one would vote for a ticket like that.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's go through those two things, David.
Yeah.
You'd tick off the primary supporters. You'd tick off Obama's. Not necessarily Hillary's. Secondly, nobody would vote and everybody would stay home. Who does a low voter turnout favor? Always. Republicans.
The Republicans, but again, I don't think no one would stand for that if Hillary was in a vice president situation. And also it's the fact that she wants to be the top dog. Bad choice of words. But she wants her chance. This is her strategy mapped out. She's not going to throw it away just to be vice president to McCain. She was already vice president.
See, that that's the one thing that I don't think she's got time to be vice president, David.
I'll give you my conspiracy, Bob.
And I'm not saying that she's sick or anything. It's just that, you know, she would be 68 at the end of McCain's term, and there's a growing sense that that's a little, you know, I mean, if we're sitting here talking about McCain's age, who if he were elected would be older on inauguration day than Ronald Reagan was, then 68's probably too old too.
I'll give you my conspiracy, and I've got this from reading Paul Craig Roberts, who I think is pretty reputable in terms of where the country's headed, and he's been there and he's seen the heart of evil, how he was side to side with Reagan. But anyways, what he says is this country is set up for a dirty bomb attack. There's a piece on Information Clearinghouse. People should check it out.
Okay.
And he talks about the scenario and how they would set it up for a false flag operation. He says those people who don't think it's plausible, and he goes through a very logical explanation of why this is. Now, to tie in with my conspiracy, Bob, if you knew things were going down and you were Senator Kincaid, and you were the Democrat of the Democrats of the top tier Democrat. You were DLC. You were just gold all the way.
Yeah.
Would you want to get in an administration that just set this up for one of the biggest time bombs this country will ever witness? Would you want to be elected? And the answer is no. You wouldn't. You wouldn't want to be in power. So here's what I think. The reason why Conyers. The reason why none of these people are moving is because they're behind the scenes, and they see how everything's going, and they look out the window like, are the people out in the street yet with the torches? No? Okay, we'll just go back inside. And what I think is going to happen is they're setting themselves up not to be elected. And that's why you don't see them trying or anything, because they know it's just going to, there's going to be an avalanche. The way that I would put this into terms we could all understand is it's like a giant game of chicken.
You first. No, you.
Yeah, yeah. And the Republicans, They like gambling all the time. Hell, look at Bill Bennett. They do risky moves that no one would ever try. Like, wow, you're gonna
and
do that.
But they only do those, David, when they know that they'll never have to pay for it. I mean, look at the subprime crisis. Okay, you can't tell me that all along when they were. I mean, because this thing was a scam. I mean, there's nothing even remotely legitimate about the way that the subprime mortgages were hustled.
Right.
And you cannot convince me that somewhere along the way somebody didn't look at somebody else and say, listen, you know, I mean, if everything goes to hell on this, we'll still be okay. We'll make the taxpayers pick it up.
But Bob, doesn't it make sense why the Democrats won't do anything? If you know it's going to go to hell, why would you want to be in charge?
Well, I've asked that question myself. You know, who wants to clean up this mess?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. If I was a senator, I wouldn't do it.
But there are true. But you underestimate the for those who have it, and I mean, I think it would. And I think those who do have it would probably show up, David, on something like the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. For those who have it, that desire for ultimate power is the biggest aphrodisiac in the world. Because even if you're the king of a burning castle,
yeah,
they still bow. At least for a while. And getting that adulation and having that power and that world shaking authority, man, I mean, that's the worst drunk in the world has nothing to compare or the worst heroin addict in the world has nothing to compare with that level of a Jones.
Well, you know,
and I apply think, that Democrat or Republican to anybody who aspires to the presidency.
Well, I agree with you to an extent, but I think Republicans have the more stronger of the addiction, and also I think that this is just a bigger symptom of a lot of people's dreams being crushed. Nobody really wants to. I don't know. No, I think there a lot of this stems from a lot of dreams being shattered. So if my dream shattered, I'm going to shatter your American dream. Because like I said, when people say
yeah, but see the Republicans don't get their dream shattered, David. That's my point.
Yes, they do, Bob. Yes, they do. And what I mean by see, you're missing the whole thing about what a dream is.
Okay.
Because I'm not talking about financial dreams. I'm talking about the dream when you were a kid. I was watching the show on TV, BBC's Hustle, and they were talking about this. They were going to do this job on this con, and this guy named Samir, and he was this ruthless business executive. But the one thing that he could never be was he wanted to be in Bollywood. He wanted to be an actor, but he could never be that because his dad really really put it on him that he needed to buckle down and go this direction. What I'm talking about, the dreams, everyone has a dream in their head, and most people don't get to fulfill it because of circumstances. And when I say, and see, that's the biggest con of all, Bob. You think that they really did get away. Nobody gets away. All, see, what happens when you make your first million? You've read about this, right? It's a high. It lasts for a little bit. And then it goes away, and then you're boxed in. You're back to feeling numb.
And it's no fun until you've made two, and two's no fun until you've made four, and four's no fun until you've made eight.
Right. So there is no getting their dreams fulfilled. And what I mean by that is,
well, that's because they don't. They don't know how to enjoy it.
No,
that's the difference between nouveau riche and old money.
No, because again, it has to do with when sometimes your dreams are better as to stay as dreams, and when you obtain them, like I said, you just start to go numb, and I think that's what we're seeing in this country to a larger degree of a lot of the rich kids of the new era. They've already have everything in front of them. It's already there, and that goes for a lot of the Republicans, and so they're just looking around like, what next? How do we play this game? And they think if an attack on Iran is going to bring them joy or happiness, it's not. And that's why I keep saying to people, you don't get away with anything, because eventually they're going to face oblivion too, and they're going to face death too. So all it is just like a pointless game of running away from something that they can't run away from. And that which brings me back to my, I really do think that the Democrats, I don't think they want to be in office, and I don't blame them.
We're going to have to agree to disagree on that one, David, because the pathology of wanting that power is something that it's probably almost incomprehensible to ordinary folks like you and me. I mean,
Waxman and Conyers, Bob. Tell me this: why have there not been any other than just hearings?
Why hasn't there been any real action?
Yeah, why hasn't there been any real?
Well, if you ask them,
because the Republicans.
If you ask them, they'll tell you, but it's because they don't have the votes.
Uh-huh.
If you want to be politically pragmatic, it's much more likely, I think, that it's because they think that if they just wait it out, that the disgust of the American people will yield them far more power than they had before. Again, it's the will to power sort of thing. It's almost what Nietzschean. And they will do anything to increase that power. 60, you know, if you're the Senate Majority Leader and you've got a 60-40 majority or 61-39 majority, you can go in and whip ass and take names. And if you've got a big old majority in the House of Representatives, you can have so scrawny few Republicans on the committees that they don't dare so much as pipsqueak without you being able to rat slap them and tell them, you know, you shut up or you won't get so much. You not only will you not get pork, baby, you won't get sow belly. And that dream for that kind of power is astonishingly potent.
I really think that they don't want to be in power because they see what's coming, and that's why you have this big.
Yeah, but we know what it looks like when a presidential candidate mails it in. I mean, I remember the Dole campaign in 1996. There was a guy who wasn't interested in being president. He was a placeholder, and that was it. Because the Republicans knew that they were going to have a hell of a lot more fun picking at the second term carcass of Bill Clinton. Nobody wanted Bob Dole to be elected president. And so
only the crazy people.
Yeah. Well, the diehards. Yeah. The people who bought the Jerry Falwell
and the people
Clinton Chronicles video and whatnot.
Their right hand.
What?
I said the people who held on to with pens with their right hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't. If it was a matter of the Democrats not wanting it, I couldn't see the vast amount of fundraising being done here. They'd go through the motions and let it just sort of be some sort of post-apocalyptic or, you know, anti-apocalyptic kabuki theater.
Not to be cynical, but I think that's a whole new level of scamville that none of us could ever begin to fathom where all that money goes. Again, I think if we're really we're going to hit the wall in this country, why would you want to be in charge of it? I would rather be in the back room counting the dollars, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, but you know what? If you hit the wall in this country and you just happen to be the one person who can save it, you wind up on the money. I mean, yeah, you become you get elevated to the level of that secular pantheon of demigods, and you get mentioned in the same breath as people like Jefferson and Roosevelt. That's why. I mean, these people, David, actually care about that stuff. I mean, it gets all over them when they think about things like legacies. That's why, you know, that's why I said, you know, there are fundamental personality issues that are wildly different from yours and mine. I'm 45 years old. I used to dream big. You know, I used to, you know, dream of having the oak paneled library with the wall that slid away and the wet bar that came out and the 10,000 megawatt stereo system and the 52 inch television and surround sound and yada 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 yada. And when I got bored, I'd get out and drive my Porsche Turbo, you know, or have it shipped and drive it on the Autobahn just to, you know, ease my boredom. But that goes away with a little bit of common sense, but there are people out there for whom it doesn't.
Yeah.
And in looking at political candidates, those are those people. You know, and it happens for a variety of reasons, David. John McCain, for instance, when John McCain goes to sleep at night, he still hears his grandfather and his father whispering in his ear what a stinking failure he is. Okay, because his father and his grandfather both made admiral, and it took something just short of an absolute miracle for John McCain to make captain. And in the Navy, captain is to admiral as colonel is to general. You know, John McCain was 894th out of 899 in his graduating class. Okay,
right.
So he's working through, he's actually, that's why there's so much commonality between him and Bush. He's working through a lot of the same pathologies in relation to his male authority figures ahead of him and his family that George Bush is. And he's still trying to prove that he's man enough. He's still trying to prove that he's tough enough. He's still trying to prove that he's got everything that his daddy and his granddaddy had when they were sailing the seven seas with a young but potent American fleet. I mean, you know, these guys were fleet admirals. Okay, I mean, and the best that John McCain can do is to set fire to an aircraft carrier with his airplane. You know, John McCain is a miserable failure within the scope of his own family.
Yeah.
That's why he gets out. He has to marry the beer heiress. He has to suck up to Charles Keating. He's always warming himself against people who can make him feel like he is more than the lonely little shunted boy that he was, going from base to base and posting to posting with his daddy. And as a consequence of that, you wind up with the kind of man that you see now. And that's, you know, that's why I don't buy in to everybody who says, well, you know, he's a hero and I reverence his service. Yeah, he can kiss my butt.
If the military complex wants McCain, then I'm even leaning more and more each day to what Robert said about a false flag. If the people aren't going to continue to shout the O word and be for Hillary and whoever, or Al Gore, the one thing that will change that is one false flag.
And we have to be cognizant of that stuff.
I'll put it up on the message board so you guys can check it out.
Okay, cool. David, I appreciate it.
All right, later.
Later now.
Bye.
And onward. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob, this is Albert. How are you?
Hey, Albert, what's going on, my friend?
Well, we're trying not to get smothered. But,
I was going to say, still on your non-shoveling strike?
Oh, I'm never shoveling again this year. So anyway, where are we at? False flag operation. Well, let me just address that for a second. Keith Olbermann mentioned the other day, I think it was in his Worst Persons of the World, something along those lines, where in Oregon, some backwater in Oregon, they had a Department of Homeland Security guy driving around with an ion detector in terms of radio.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now I don't know if anyone here, but I'll just re-say it.
Yeah.
He was driving on the highway. And he got a hit. And
yeah, isotope detector. That's what it was. It was an isotope detector.
Yeah, isotope. That's what it was, yeah. And he got a hit, and it was on a vehicle traveling 70 miles an hour in the other lane, you know, going the other way. So he turns around, da-da-da-da-da, and he picks it up and checks the car, and it was a cat that got some
radiation therapy because it had cat cancer.
3 days before. Now, if we've got sensors on the ground, people running around, that's that sensitive. I mean, now I'll tell you something. You know, I've said this before, and I've said it a million times, that a nuclear bomb will never legitimately be able to be snuck into this country or near this country because of our satellites in space would pick it up like looking at a sun. I mean, we pick them up so fast it wouldn't even be funny. And the thing is it might not pick up a cat, those satellites, but they would certainly pick up a bomb. But if we got guys already on the ground. Now, I'm not saying that there ain't going to be no false flag. I'm just saying that if it does, this is good information for everyone to know so we can quickly extinguish this whole attack deal that, you know, I mean, if they could pick up a cat that had some chemotherapy, then they can certainly pick up a, you know.
Well, but then again, that's the problem. They've got the isotope. I mean, this is at least what I thought when I saw that Olbermann piece, Albert. The problem is that they've got the isotope detector in the middle of a median in Bellingham, Washington, as opposed to having it, say, on the gate that all the container ship semis have to drive through.
Oh, no, I hear you. Now, listen, there's very few that are I've been quite conspiratorial in my life. And I certainly understand how certain factions in the government and certain groups that have a lot of power and wield a lot of power have certain interests that would certainly be served by any type of false flag attack, in our history or in the future.
See, I'm not nearly as bothered by the idea of a false flag attack as a real flag attack.
Well, that's
the bomb, either either conventional or nuclear or low yield or whatever, any attack on Iran within enough time before the presidential and congressional elections to make it sway the populace. And if you don't think the Republicans would do something as sleazy as that, well, I've got two words for you: October surprise.
I certainly hear you. I don't think we have the patience for that anymore. And I know many people are functional illiterates, and it's quite scary. It really is. However, there are a lot more people now with their eyes wide open than there were in 2000 and 2004. There's more now. There's probably 10 times the amount that had their eyes open than even in 2004. So I really highly doubt that any type of shenanigans like that would be anywhere near effective. It would probably, hopefully, I'd like to think it would trigger a complete and utter uprising. Now,
time out. I'm sorry. I got blow the whistle.
Go ahead.
Do you believe, honest to God, Albert, that there is anything on earth that would cause the American people to come up out of their somnambulatory state and uprise over, anything? Really? That makes you a way bigger optimist than me.
Well, I do have a little bit of optimist in me. However, this is one of those, we have to take the whole picture into account. The American people are only the way they are because of the lifestyle that the people in power enable us to have. And as that illusion comes crashing down further and further and further, it's almost like, you know how Americans are with vanquishing people who were previously in the spotlight and so on and so on. You know what I'm saying? Like people who, we're fair weather fans to the max.
Oh, yeah, that's why I keep saying we like the start of wars and not the middle and end of them.
Well, yeah, some of us, most of us. But and real quick, I just got to say that whole Hillary McCain thing, that would blow up in their face like Pa, what's his name, on Little House on the Prairie's little nitroglycerin carriage. That wouldn't work. That would fail, honestly.
Oh, there's the analogy of the night.
Well, it's gonna. McCain is gonna fail. Obama's gonna get it, and we're just gonna have to maintain all hands on deck for when we hit the wall, because we all see it. They all see it, and these people on Wall Street, they certainly know what's coming. They can sit there and inflate it with $100 billion here, and which is a ton of money, by the way. They could do all this crap. But all it is, it's like trying to into the Hindenburg. You know what I'm saying? It's not going to do anything.
We've seen this movie before. There were cash infusions and all kinds of shenanigans and monkey shines that were cut in 1929.
Yeah.
And, for a couple of days, they thought, okay, it's going to rebound. Thank God. And then it went in the toilet again, and they did some more, and it went in the toilet again, and it did some more, and it went in the toilet. And after a while, they just looked up and went, wow, it's in the toilet.
Well, yeah, and hopefully, in my optimistic love. And
without ever having it dawn on them that anything that you pluck out of the toilet is generally not going to be anything you wanted in the first place.
True, and especially if you're going to just add more to it.
And I think that's the biggest problem, is they're not even nowhere near addressing inflation. They're just, they're feeding the fire of it. They're, you know, I mean, we'd be better off just burning barrels of money, actually. I mean, we really would. We'd be better off just burning $100 billion that's in circulation now. We'd be better off letting these banks fail, letting certainly some of these banks fail, especially these parasitic ones. We'd be
You mean the non-bank banks?
These what?
The non-bank banks?
Yeah.
The banks that aren't really banks?
Yeah, these banks that send out spam all the time, and they want to give you, you know, this and that and so on and so forth.
The so-called Wall Street banks.
Well, them too. Well,
yeah, nobody writes a check on Bear Stearns.
Yeah, well, Bear Stearns. That's a.
Hey, I'm going to shift gears on you here just because I want to hear your thoughts on this. I'm sitting here looking at the headlines on CNN, Albert.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the MLK wiretaps have been released.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how it's headlined. And I couldn't help seeing this and just sort of having it play into the national dialogue for me. This is how CNN puts it on their headlines page, latest news. FBI's MLK wiretaps called wonderful resource. You see, that's the way. We don't know which wonderful resource we're going to have, but thank God we're bugging everybody's phone calls, because then we'll have the wonderful resource in 40 years.
Oh, God, that's so Orwellian. Oh, my God, that's amazing.
I mean...
I don't know. Oh, Jesus. That is,
you know, and the monitors are LCD now, so, you know, you're not thinking, you know, one of these days I'm going to put my fist through it like you would with a CRT monitor, but, you know, wonderful resource, Albert.
Yeah, well, isn't it? It's a wonderful freedom to be monitored. It's just, it's Orwellian, and I tell you, that's why, you know... You got a lot of people, and you'll sit there and you'll talk with them, and they'll be like, "Oh, they ain't doing no wiretaps on you. Oh, you got nothing to hide. What are you worried about?"
Yeah, I just look at him and say, "Prove it."
That, but at the same time, I mean, when we're sitting here looking at forcing people to remove their nipple rings,
Jesus.
Which I don't think is any more outrageous than forcing a mother to drink her breast milk.
No.
Or a grandmother to, you know, I don't even know.
Well, yeah, copping a feel on Granny because she had the unmitigated temerity to wear an underwire bra to the airport.
God, don't you know they need the support?
You guys do that stuff, okay? Because I'll catch hell. But yeah, I mean,
seriously. I mean, you know, come on. I mean, but at the same time, I mean, I'm sitting here. I mean, the Republicans are doomed. I don't think that no matter who takes office, I don't think they're going to be able to get away with the fact that the reason that we're in this mess is because of them.
Who was the Republican who ran against FDR for his second term?
I don't know.
Who was the Republican who ran against FDR for his third term? How about his fourth?
I forget the guy's name.
Okay. I'm not trying to show you I'm smarter. I don't know the name either.
Yeah.
This is not me showing off. This is making a point.
No,
what the Republicans are good at, Albert, is knowing when, you know, they're a Kenny Rogers song. Know when to hold them and know when to fold them. And when they fold, they just, beep, you know, oh, I'm sorry, they're off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit there quietly, you know, all coiled up like a hibernating snake. And they wait until America forgets what they did to them the last time. And then they come back talking the same old sorry snake oil, crazy, you know, just BS, crazy, insane free market garbage. And you know, the people with the people with the functional illiteracy or the sixth grade comprehension of politics go, "Oh, you know what? Sounds like he's telling me I can be rich, too. I'm going to vote for him." Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're right. No, you're exactly right. And that's a sad, you know, it's a sad little niche in the whole group there. But I really, you know, I, I,
I don't see them. I don't see them doing much of anything. I see them doing a lot of losing. And I hope what you were saying earlier, I forget with whom, Sandra, I think where they're talking about just sitting there letting Conyers and all these guys like just lay in wait until there is actually a mega majority, I think that that's an essential what we're going to need. And we're going to need, you know, this recession is going to, in my ear, talk about optimistic. Optimistically, it's going to be a depression. But, in terms of an attack on Iran, this is one of those things. This is one of the beauties of, this is not 1960. They've already tried. This is the thing I just wanted people to realize. They've already tried their Gulf of Tonkin. They've tried it a couple of times, and it's failed. It's failed. Why? Because the lie never had a chance to get set in. They tried when the British troops got... I mean, think about it. If this was 1960, there was no internet, and this is the same exact war was going down in Iraq and all that other stuff, and then Iran picks up these British troops, what would have happened? We'd already be at war. And what happened in 1960? If all of a sudden these jet boats are zooming around, zip, around our, or in their water, but around our warships, they attacked us, boom, we're on to go. 20 years later, we'll find out it's totally false.
Yeah, but then again, we didn't do it over the Pueblo or the Mayaguez. I'm not just arguing for the sake of argument. This is... I understand your point, and it makes a lot of sense. But and what you're arguing is that the scrutiny that they're under circumscribes some of their abilities, if I understand you correctly.
And it does, and I don't even think that they're hip to it as much as I think that they're hip to we can't do this, but I don't even think that they're not even hip to the technology. They don't really understand it. They don't really understand what the internet represents. They don't understand that, you know, they can't shut it down. There's nothing they can do to shut it down. They'd have to rip every phone line out, cut the power in order to do something along
those lines. Yeah, but how many lines did they lop going into Iran a month or so back?
Well, that's a different deal. But the same thing you say that, if Iran has enough connections, they can jack out another way. They don't have to go through that way. I mean, there really is. I mean, Iran, and I worry about it. I worry about Venezuela even more than I worry about Iran.
Yeah, that'd be a lot easier. Shorter trip.
And it has tons of oil, and Hugo Chavez is an antichrist, and all the other crap that they try to spew about him. But, you know, even that would be an utter failure. I mean, I really don't see that the Republicans, as much as the morons that they are, which is wake up morons, that's what it was.
Yeah, okay.
That's a favorite picture of mine. That's a classic. God, I love that picture. Anyway, but, you know, with guys like that don't even have the grit to go another 6 months in another invasion. I mean, sure, they'll get that adrenaline high, but in reality, we cannot sustain this. We just can't. And you got to sit here and you got to think of all the little balls you got to juggle to keep the Americans under.
Oh, I know. And dropping one is the same as dropping them all.
Exactly. I mean, we're sitting here. I mean, with gas prices jacking up, $4 this summer, no problem. I mean, we got.
Yeah, but boy, if we get Iran's oil, we can drop your oil back down, your gas down back down $2 a gallon.
That might work for a month or two. But the thing is, once we see the losses that's going to entail, I mean, seriously, one of the reasons Admiral Fallon, you know, as much as the people could say what have you, with this and that, he was a big failure in terms of being the chief commander over there. However, he understood something. And I've told you this, that Iran has a massive amount of anti-ship missiles. And one of them can take out a billion-dollar warship. We cannot sustain. I mean, could you imagine?
The highfalutin Aegis cruisers. I get it.
A carrier.
Yeah.
A carrier.
But I mean, the Aegis system itself, I think, is, or some more modern permutation of it, is aboard every American warship, just about. And you know, it fires out the chaff to divert the missiles. Well, you know what? if they've got enough to shoot 10 at you and you divert 9, you still lose.
Exactly. That's what, and that's the thing. I mean, even the Exocet, which is the ones that will probably get diverted with the chaff. The other two, I mean, from what I've read about them, they if I was on a ship and I heard one of those was inbound, I'd be in the water. I'd grab a life jacket and boop, I'm gone. Because I'm telling you right now, that thing will hit, and it's going too fast.
Yeah, and we don't have armor for diddly on those so-called fast frigates. They're not faster than a missile.
Fast frigates carry anything. Anything we have out there, it'll just chew it up. And then they have the Yonkuts, which is an even more advanced version. Plus, they got, you know, I don't see Iran being a cakewalk. I really don't. I mean, I really don't see...
No, see, but you don't, and I don't. But you know what? The guys in the White House don't care.
Yeah, but...
Because they think it's... The idiots in the White House and their little lick spittles at the Pentagon, you know, the non-Fallon types...
Yeah.
They see more stars, more bars, and the guys in the White House really like to watch things go boom. I mean, their pathology is that sick, Albert.
Yeah, I understand.
And frankly, they think that everything is cured by a mushroom cloud.
Now see, that would be, well, I mean, and that's something I don't think anybody even has to worry about, even if it happens. Don't worry about it.
And they also think, because remember, these are the smartest guys in the room. These are the Vulcans, remember? They think they know where every single last piece of munition that Iran possesses is. Oh, we've got... these guys who thought that a truck parked under a palm tree was a mobile weapons lab, they think they know where all the guns are.
Oh, they think... They thought the...
And so they'll send, you know, they'll send in a bunch of... bunch of, you know, stealth bombers from and radar jammers from Sierra Leone or wherever, and think that they got them all. Because listen, at the end of the day, there is inherent racism in this calculus.
They think
the Persians. No kidding. I'm convinced of this. George Bush thinks the Persians are Arabs.
Probably.
He also thinks they're brown people. Now, this is not my thinking. This is my projection of his thinking. And he thinks brown equals inferior. Brown equals lesser the mental capabilities.
I agree with you.
And it's the kind of absolute rock solid dirt stupid mistake that you would expect. George Bush to make. Oh, by the way, trivia moment, Albert. FDR versus Hoover in 1932, Alf Landon in 1936, Wendell Willkie in 1940, and Dewey in 1944. Yeah, toaster goes to David in Tennessee.
Excellent. Now, I remember the Landon. That was the guy I couldn't think of. He actually had to have...
Well, you'd think I would remember Wendell Willkie because of the fun that the Warner Brothers had with him in the cartoons, where Daffy Duck looks up and says, "Who do you think it is, Wendell Willkie?" Yeah, but...
You know. See, that's why when you're a kid, you don't have history. Those kind of things will fly right over your head.
I'll know it forever now.
I would have never known.
I got a couple more blinkies here I want to hit, Albert, but man, you know, once again...
I'll get back with you.
Right out of the
Bob.
Right out of the park. Take care.
All right, bye.
Bye. Hi, who I got?
Steven, Bob.
Hey, Luke, what's up?
Well, first of all, I don't know about you, but I burned my bracket, so life is good.
Oh, yeah, the first round just did me in, it was over.
Yeah, it's okay. Let's see, let's get on to some good stuff. One thing I've got to disagree with Ben. It's like, Ben, I'm sorry, but last time I checked, I'm blank on it all of a sudden, that Lieberman was one of the ones pushing the impeachment. So I just don't see him being suggested to Al Gore by the Clintons.
Okay.
Because remember, because they kept all the time playing Lieberman's speech, you know, when they were impeaching Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
Because like the boys over at Fox Noise, they played that every chance they could.
Yeah, about, what was it, moral turpitude and...
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay, let's see. On the thing about the October surprise, you know, like you were saying, all they've got to do is do it about the middle of October and let it last through the election. And we talked about this before. It won't be the U.S. attacking Iran. It'll be the Israelis going in attacking Iran. Iran dares to defend themselves. Then we attack them because they attacked Israel. You know, we'll go through this as a third party.
Yeah, see, whenever we start talking about this stuff, we have to think about scenarios that would be insane. I mean, certifiably straight jacket, rubber room, purple crayon in the toes, insane.
It wasn't Mission Impossible used to run, those kind of things.
Yeah.
You're looking at going,
But you have to think about that stuff because that really is how these freaks think.
Well, like I said, I still think that's what you had with the thing when they went into Syria earlier at the end of last year. Because I think that was just the warm-up to see if they could reach the Iranian sites, you know, with the extra fuel tanks and all that, the drop tanks.
Yeah.
Because they want to know that they can go in there and have a good chance of getting back and get shot at, and then they can claim, well, we were attacked.
And, we've got some handy-dandy nuclear submarines in the Persian Gulf. We've got some folks, we've got some naval vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Have we still got both the carriers out there, or do they finally rotate the third one out?
I think the third one went home, but I don't know about the second.
Because I think at one time, like I say, they had two separate carrier groups in the Med. So.
Well, no, at one point we had two carrier groups in the Gulf.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
How do you even turn that around?
That's what I mean. That's the thing that blows your mind, is because most people don't realize how small that really is for a carrier group. But they were just about running into each other. I mean, it was sort of like, well, you're at 6 o'clock and we're at 12 o'clock and we're sitting here doing this counterclockwise.
Yeah, and they brought a couple of New York City traffic cops. Hey, slow it down, hey.
But the thing where he thought earlier about McCain and Hillary, No. Now, like I say, you may see McCain and Lieberman. I wouldn't put that past them.
See, I can't ascribe that level of downright demonicness to Hillary. I just can't.
No. I think if Hillary had the nomination and had her choice, I think she'd pick Edwards. You know, pull in the populist part.
Right, and the warm fuzzy.
The South, yeah. Probably.
Well, go for the South and some of the warm fuzzy,
But you know what I mean? I think that's who she would pick if she had her druthers. People keep saying but it's like you got to have somebody that's known.
She'd have to have somebody who, frankly, is more personable.
Yeah.
Because while I'm told that she is very warm and very genial and very kind and decent in a one-on-one situation, she ain't Bill with a crowd. She's just not. She's her. And that's not any positive or negative reflection on her, but as compared with Obama's stump style, he wins hands down.
Oh, yeah. But like we said, just always remember in 2000, it ain't style that you want. You want somebody with some substance.
Yeah, and I don't want to drink a beer with anybody. I want a beer, I know where they sell the beer, and I'll go get me one.
And right now we need a wonk. I want somebody who may not be able to say what's going to happen every day, but I want somebody who's got ideas what they're going to do for the first 6 months. They've already got some plans, you know, we're going to do this and this and this.
And that's not to say that Obama doesn't.
No, but I think she's more, I don't say the word wonkish, but she's more detail-oriented, let's put it that way.
She is.
She's thought it out.
Yeah, and she's book savvy.
Because I'm sorry, the one thing that bugs me most about Obama is, I'm sorry to say, it reminds me of George W. It's like, don't worry, we'll figure it out once we're in. It's like, oh!
Yeah, I don't ever want to be told that anybody, any presidential candidate, especially any Democrat, and this is not to say that Obama has, because he hasn't, but I don't want to be told that anybody is going to, don't worry, we're going to surround him with smart people.
Yeah, but like I say, because the one who's still making the decisions for the last 8 years has been the stupid one. You can surround him with smart people, but he ignores them.
Well, yeah, and you know what? If you're 0 for 1 and then you go 0 for 2, 2 out of 3 is out of the question.
Well, you know, it's like I say, you know, remember we had the NSA, I can't think what his name was.
Mukasey?
No,
that's the Attorney General.
No, at the beginning, in 2000. the one who'd been you know, who said he was running out with his hair on fire.
The Clark, Richard Clark.
Yeah, there you have him. And, you know, he was. Everybody said he, you know, he's the man that knows, and of course he said it. They looked at him like, "What do you mean? You know, how dare you say things are wrong? No, we ain't wrong.
I don't care who you are, you're just crazy." Yeah, yeah, I know.
I mean, when you have
But it wasn't even that. It was you know, get out of the way. We're doing stuff here, okay?
Well, I mean, was it Kashmiri? I mean, here you go.
Shall Kashmiri? Yeah,
saying,
right.
Look, here's what you got to have. And they go, no, we do it much less than that.
Was it Shall Kashmiri or Shinseki?
Well, it was Kashmiri what it originally, or well, maybe it was Shinseki. I'm sorry.
But I do too, obviously. But yeah, this is going to take 500,000 people. No, it ain't neither. They ain't got that many flowers putting into our guns.
Oh God!
Don't want to make it harder on them. It has to be
somebody else on the line.
Well, we're out of time. But Luke, thanks so much.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Have a good evening.
Bye now. Wow, this one flew by. Might even do some highlight reel material on there. Yeah, highlight reel. Sure. Thanks, everybody. And a reminder, make use of the brand new HeadOnRadioNetwork.com fora. That's HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/forum, F-O-R-U-M. Go right there, easy and free. Sign up, share your thoughts. Make that thing light up. Coming up, a rerun from, let me see here, January the 25th of Strictly Confidential with Peter Godbold. I have no idea what it is. But I hope you enjoy it, and I hope it's not one I have. I've got to start making a list of the stuff that I replay. Sorry, some of this is done on the fly. I mean, it just is. Many thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, to Peter Godbold, our IT professional, to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, who kept liberal talk alive even when no one thought there was a reason for it. He proved him wrong. At whiterosesociety.org. Ben's raising funds right now. It's a gotta. If you value what happens on the horn, you value the hard work of Ben Birch at whiterosesociety.org. Many, many thanks to the hardworking folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Coal River Mountain Watch leading the fight for a sustainable Appalachia and a sustainable America. And always, always, always. RMR. Gina, it's all for you.
the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 109 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network, and also brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch. Their site is crmw.net. Please take a look and find out what's going on in West Virginia. Most of us have not a clue. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Friday, January the 25th, 2008. Let that be recorded as a day that Peter did not get a nap. This is important to listeners because they are aware that I am fairly cranky when I do not have a nap and am prone to email people prior to 9 a.m., which you really don't want to happen. So in case if you are listening on a Friday evening, which is January the 25th, 2008, shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time, you're indeed listening to a live show. You're welcome to phone in and participate. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-443-2366. That's toll-free. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. Remember, we are listener-supported, so every bit helps. That telephone number is 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. Last evening, that would have been Thursday, I promised you that our guest this evening would be a Mr. Utley, and Justin Utley is his full name. Justin is an up-and-coming out gay musician and songwriter, and doesn't do dance music like we often do here. He's an entirely different genre. He's from Utah, amazingly enough, amazing young man. And we had to reschedule that. Justin will be with us this coming Wednesday evening, and that will be a show that you don't want to miss. He comes highly recommended by someone else who has interviewed on the show, and everything I can find out about Justin is just remarkable. So we'll be looking forward to that. So this evening is a Just Us show on the network. We'll be having music and news and callers and all kinds of interesting things. The show site, by the way, is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests as well as to the guests' websites. And you'll find links to audio archives from past shows. You'll find links to the chat room, which is active as I speak, and I do encourage you to go by there and stop in. You will find an amazing assortment of people. If you're kind of shy and don't feel like talking at first, you could just log in and what we call alert. And that's fine. You're welcome to join us. That's the link will be at strictlyconfidentialradio.com.